don't mean to be bold, but I gotta let you know, Leah's got a plan for you, and I can't let go.
This next topic may not be appropriate for all listeners. Singer-songwriter R. Kelly was in court today. For day one of his trial on sexual abuse and racketeering charges, he's pleaded not guilty, but if convicted, could face decades in prison. Kelly was acquitted on charges of child pornography back in 2008, but recently several women have accused him of sexual abuse. We're going to play a clip now from a documentary that aired on the Lifetime Network. Accuser Kitty Jones talks about dating R. Kelly in 2011 and how, as she tells it, he indoctrinated women.
He calls it training you. You definitely had to ask to go to the restroom, stand up when he walks in the room. You had to ask for your food.
NPR's Andrew Limbong joins us now for more on the trial, which, by the way, will not be televised. Hi, Andrew.
Hey, Scott.
Hey, so it's been 13 years since R. Kelly was last on trial and he was acquitted of child pornography charges. What is the main difference in this case?
So, yeah, if you think back to that 2008 trial, that was a very narrow scope, right? That focused on one tape and one alleged victim who, you know, didn't testify, and the alleged victim's family didn't testify either, right? Mm-hmm. So there wasn't a lot to work off of from the prosecutor's standpoint. Here, it's much different. The breadth of the case is much larger. The case includes a number of alleged victims, some of whom are expected to actually speak in front of the court throughout this trial. And it goes beyond just one thing, right? It covers trafficking, kidnapping, forced labor, bribery, right? And the overarching racketeering charge. You know, there's a lot more evidence to use, and there's a lot more options for the prosecution to go with.
And let me ask you about the racketeering charge, which seems to be one of the big overarching questions here. Tell me about that.
The racketeering charge is interesting. I think most listeners might be most familiar with it as like a RICO statute, right? Mm-hmm. Which is more often used against, you know, mafia type, organized crime type cases. But the idea here is that R. Kelly is at the center of what's called like an enterprise, right? R. Kelly has commanded either like managers or bodymen or drivers to help conduct or lure women or, you know, get them on a plane or in a car, all in this web of organized crime as he lures women into being allegedly abused and exploited sexually.
Okay, understand now. In the meantime, we, of course, have had this vibrant Me Too conversation in the U.S. How has that conversation connected to this trial, I guess, inside the court and outside the court?
So during the jury selection process, there was a lot of talk and questioning of each person about, you know, how much did they know about R. Kelly? What did they think about the wider Me Too movement? How do they feel about these sort of like big issues that we, you know, as a country have all sort of been dealing with? And so they lean towards people who, you know, like most jurors, like didn't know much about the case and had not strong feelings either way about it. But outside the courtroom, it's interesting because these allegations aren't new, right? Like Jim DeRogatis, who is the music critic and reporter over at the Chicago Sun-Times, has been writing about this since 2000. What's changed, you know, in the Me Too era and then plus the documentary Surviving R. Kelly, I think that documentary makes the point that these women weren't listened to because the accusers were mostly Black women and girls. And so we as a society has sort of like devalued what they had to say when it came to R. Kelly, who, you know, is a huge pop star. I just want to remind people that, like, even as he sort of disappeared from terrestrial radio airwaves, he gets massive pull on Spotify, right? The company says that he gets 5.2 million listeners a month, right? And he still has his supporters out there. So while his stature as a pop figure may have diminished a bit, it's still there.
Now, this trial in Brooklyn is one of several federal and state trials that R. Kelly is facing. So after this trial, what else is happening here?
So there's another federal trial that'll take place, you know, sometime after this New York one wraps up in Illinois. And that one is based off of child pornography charges as well as obstruction of justice, right? And so what happens in the New York trial will sort of impact what happens there, right? Because if he is charged on, you know, if he's found guilty on any of these charges in New York, they can use that in their case in Illinois.
Yep, I understand. Okay, that is NPR's Andrew Limbong. Andrew, thanks.
Thanks, Scott.
Take a look, it's in a book, a reading rainbow.
Shivering and shaking through the beautiful green forest, I finally noticed the bridge, and I couldn't believe what I saw next. Walking on the magical Snake Charm Bridge was Anime, with beautiful, milky, white skin. Her skin was so smooth as silk. She had eyes as blue as the Aladdin Ocean. She looked so fragile and feminine. If I touched her, she would shatter. She was the epitome of natural beauty. She was, without a doubt, a woman.
That was a very icky paragraph.
What? Who are you to say that? I wrote that myself.
Well, I like to call myself a fantasy book fanatic. Fun fact, last year alone, I read a total of 68 fantasy books.
Wait, why do you like fantasy books so much?
Well, it gives me an escape from reality. When I'm reading, I feel like I'm in another world, a world where there's no sexism, racism, or any other ism for that matter. There's something so magical about that.
But what's wrong with fantasy? You love fantasy, I love fantasy.
I've been noticing that a lot of fantasy books have problematic issues. The same things I want to escape from are exactly what I'm seeing. So many authors say the whole point of fantasy is it's not supposed to resemble anything from our world. But if that statement is correct, then why do so many authors constantly use white skin tones to describe their characters?
Okay, but that's just one example.
Or, why won't authors want to include POC characters, they usually put some sort of stereotype twist. Like, time and time again, the evil character or villain is someone who's either dark-skinned or has BIPOC features. And the good person is usually someone who has Eurocentric features. Like, why can't the character have orange skin with purple eyes?
But it's all fiction. Why does it matter?
Let me stop you right there. I want you to remember all the fairy tales you read growing up. Did those have a direct correlation on how you perceived the world?
Okay, could you give me an example?
Okay, let's take Cinderella. She had an evil stepmother, right? Now, I want you to think at that point after watching, did you fear having any sort of stepmother because she might be evil? I know I did, and I only thought this because of the Cinderella story.
Okay.
Or, how about the boogeyman hiding under your bed? Did you fear this before you ever heard a story about the boogeyman? Probably not.
Oh, I never noticed that.
Exactly. This is why having characters that constantly have Eurocentric features is an issue. It makes it seem that beauty only has one form, and that if you have anything that is different, it is ugly in a way. Like, if all the attractive people in fantasy books only have Eurocentric features, what are the people who don't have those features going to think about themselves? Also, people are going to think that beauty automatically equals whiteness.
Ah, that makes a lot of sense. But now I feel like basically all the fantasy books have this in their writing. I mean, what am I supposed to do now?
Well, I want you to know you can read books that have great representation as well as an amazing plot. I love the vibe of your fantasy paragraph in the beginning, but I think you can add some spice. Maybe take some of what we talked about today and put it in your writing.
Okay. How about this? Shivering and shaking through the beautiful green forest, I finally noticed the bridge. And I could not believe what I saw next. Walking on the magical Snake Charm Bridge was Anime. She had magnificent lavender skin that was so glowy. The color of her eyes will be forever engraved in my brain. It was this bright amber color. She truly looked beautiful. She looked so out of this world.
Wow, that was great. I loved it.
Your attention, please. During the summer when the pandemic seemed to decline, only to fire up again, many Americans made travel plans. Airports are packed, as they once were, although many travelers face delays and cancellations. NPR's David Shaper reports from Chicago.
Getting a flight from New York to Chicago should be easy enough, but not for Jillian Estanich, who was stuck at LaGuardia last week for a second straight day.
I was at the airport yesterday for 7 hours. I'm now looking at being at the airport for another 7 hours today.
Estanich's first flight home to Chicago after a two-week vacation was canceled because of storms. She tried to get on numerous other flights standby, but to no avail. United rebooked her on a flight early the next morning, but that was delayed again and again and again. Once finally in the air, as the plane got over Indiana, more trouble. It was forced to circle to avoid more storms.
We got inched a little bit closer, and then they started circling us again. And at that point, they closed O'Hare, and we did not have enough fuel. So we got diverted to Indianapolis.
After refueling and waiting a couple of hours for O'Hare to reopen, the crew timed out. Estanich thought about renting a car, but the only place open at midnight had a huge line and wanted $600. So she rebooked for 11:30 the next day. But even that flight was delayed, not just once, but twice.
And at that point, I just cried and cried and cried.
Fed up, the 40-year-old rented a car and drove the 3 hours home to Chicago, albeit through the violent thunderstorm that had delayed her flight.
Was just like a, you know, one thing after another just going horrifically wrong.
Jillian Estanich is not alone, as even in the best of times, summer storms often mess up air travel. But this year is worse than most summers, and that's due in part to the near shutdown in air travel during the pandemic. Data from the flight tracking site FlightAware.com shows that 25% of all domestic commercial airline flights since June have either been delayed or canceled.
I think it's been a summer of chaos with a little sprinkling of excitement.
Nick Ewan writes about air travel for the Points Guy website and says while there's been a huge surge in domestic air travel demand,
airlines then have been a little bit slower to adjust to this sudden increase in demand. So there have been some staffing shortages, long hold times. And then, of course, you throw in weather, technology that can not always be the most reliable. And there are the potential for some pretty significant headaches if you are taking to the skies this summer.
Some airlines have had it especially bad. Earlier this month, Spirit was canceling up to 60% of its flights each day. Southwest and American both had major problems earlier this summer. Kathleen Bangs is a former commercial airline pilot, now with FlightAware.
The biggest problem across the board for a lot of carriers was this huge halt, this grinding to a halt shutdown with the pandemic.
Bang says it can take a while to get planes that were mothballed in the desert during the pandemic airworthy again. And it can take even longer to retrain idled pilots.
It's not just coming back to work on the airplane you were on. Seniority might dictate that when you come back, you're in a different seat, meaning you've moved from captain to co-pilot or back again, and to a different airplane, which necessitates even more training.
Bang says as airlines catch up on bringing back and retraining pilots, flight attendants, and other staff, air travel demand is now beginning to cool amid a surge in Delta variant COVID cases. David Shaper, NPR News, Chicago.
Well, Haiti is on the list of what's supposed to be. Haiti, the people who are called Haitians, predominantly are people who are classified as non-white. So they're not supposed to ever have anything under the system of white supremacy except punishment
yeah.
for being arrogant enough under Toussaint to think that you, with your military skills, can take us over or tell us what to do. So many a historian has said that the reason Haiti is in the shape that it's in now, and sort of like the head wagon people of the world, you might say, everybody kind of looks on them with great pity. It's because the white supremacists made that decision.
More than 1,200 people are now known to have been killed in Saturday's devastating earthquake in Haiti. Thousands more were injured, and the National Civil Protection Service says local hospitals are struggling to cope. Major damage is reported in the cities of Jeremy and Lekai, where rescuers are trying to locate people still trapped under the rubble. Aid workers are racing to provide food, water and shelter ahead of an expected tropical storm. Haiti's Prime Minister, Ariel Henry, said he wanted all aid donations to be administered centrally to avoid corruption.
In this crisis, we want more appropriate responses than those we received after the 2010 earthquake. All aid that will come from outside the country must go through civil protection. I do not want aid to arrive in a disorderly manner where everyone decides what they want.
Our correspondent, James Clayton, who's in Haiti, gave the latest to Jannat Jalil.
The road from Port-au-Prince to Lacaille is notorious in Haiti. There have been kidnappings along that road. There is a sense of lawlessness generally in Haiti, not just because of the earthquake, but because of political tensions, political turmoil. The president was assassinated last month. So I think what you're seeing is a real lack of information coming out about what's actually happening on the ground in that area.
And we heard there also about a lack of equipment. How much international help is Haiti getting? It desperately needs it.
It's one of those situations where a lot of people, a lot of countries have committed already a lot of money. The issue with Haiti has always been whether that goodwill, whether that money can actually get to the right place. And the issue that Haiti had in 2010, when it had that massive earthquake, which, by the way, wasn't as big as the earthquake on Saturday. But when that happened in 2010, billions were committed to Haiti, to trying to restore Haiti. And so much of that money didn't get to where it should. And I think a lot of Haitians at the moment are slightly skeptical of not just their own government's ability to react to this, but the international community too.
Yes, the Prime Minister was talking about that, wasn't he? Because there is concern about whether the lessons have been learnt from 11 years ago when all that money was squandered.
Exactly. I mean, and there are horror stories about how that money was spent. And I don't think it was a time that the West remembers particularly fondly in terms of how they reacted to that. It's very clear that there needs to be pretty fast resources that should be sent to that area. The issue is there are not that many planes, and the planes that are getting there are often small planes. So there's only so much equipment that they can actually take in. And that's why you're hearing stories about people going through the rubble with their hands, with spades. There's just not enough equipment to actually do this in a kind of safe way. And obviously, the one thing we learned from the 2010 Haiti earthquake is people do survive these things. They survive under the rubble for days. I mean, there are some stories of people surviving for over a week. So it's possible there are still survivors there, but they just can't get to them. A lot of the people on the ground are very worried, quite rightly, about going back into their homes because of potential aftershocks. So people are sleeping outside, sleeping in tents if they can. Some people I've heard are sleeping in their cars. There will be a big issue in Lacaille and Jérémy, where the two main places where this earthquake hits, if it starts to rain.
James Clayton in Haiti.
The tears of empire. With the dramatic fall of Kabul to the forces of the Taliban, the alligator tears of the political class are falling, decrying the costs of U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. What has been thoroughly forgotten, however, is the unprecedented mass protests of February 2003, before the war began, when the earth shook with anti-war fervor in countries across the globe. Then President George W. Bush would ignore these protests as a mere focus group. His words, focus group. In the 2004 book, The Citizens of the Empire, author and critic Robert Jensen recounted the worldwide actions on February 15, 2003 were the single largest political demonstration in history. Millions of people all over the globe poured into the streets to try to derail the Bush administration's mad rush to war. How, in an alleged democracy, can the government so easily ignore the views of millions It happened, and chaos came to Afghanistan and wreaked havoc for over 20 years. What if the protests had won? We will never know. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
I was the first, one of the first. My first day was state trooper coming, putting me in the back seat of the car, and meeting the other black kids with six of us. And seeing all of those parents and also KKK members having signs and throwing cans at us, spitting at us. We lived in the threat of death every day, every day. So I was just lost in this vacuum between integration and segregation and racism. That was my childhood. I was angry for years. Angry. Very angry.
In-person instruction is something many parents have been demanding during the pandemic because they say virtual classes are not optimal for kids' learning and social engagement. But there are some black parents in Los Angeles who would rather keep their kids at home because they say school bullying was unbearable for their children. In fact, according to a survey by parents' advocacy group Speak Up, nearly half of black parents who participated in the poll said they wanted to continue with distance learning for their children because of severe bullying. One of those parents joins me now, Britannia Hurst. Her son Aiden is in the fourth grade. Britannia, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here, Larry.
Well, it's nice to have you. You know, we all know that it's harder for kids to learn through Zoom screens, right? But you would rather have Aiden learn from home because bullying affected him so much. Can you describe just how bad things were?
I do feel that Aiden did learn more at home. It definitely opened up a comfort level for him and just allowing him to ask a question and be comfortable in asking it. I feel the black boy experience in LAUSD sometimes can be a bit of a challenge. Just being bullied and asking for help, maybe being relentless to ask the teacher if the teacher could possibly be a part of the problem.
So were there things that sort of caused you to make this decision, though?
Right before the pandemic, we had experienced an issue with his teacher in the second grade. The students were lining up to get into class, and I stood by just to watch him go in. I love having that experience with him. And this particular morning, I witnessed a student of another race get hit in the line. And the teacher of another race, she turned around and just started accusing Aiden. She just started yelling at him and waving her finger in his face. She never asked, and I just sat there in disbelief. There was another student trying to tell the teacher that it wasn't Aiden. It was a different person who actually hit the little girl. And the teacher just shushed the student. But I'll never forget, because when something happens between a black boy and a female of another race, the aggressor is automatically assumed to be the black boy. That made me feel weary as a parent, like, okay, is my son going to be okay and safe in this environment now with this teacher who potentially does not believe my son?
Some black parents within LA Unified say they can't just drop off their kids and trust the school to get them ready for the future. Do you agree with that?
I agree. However, I do feel that no school is fully prepared to just drop off the student and leave the future entirely on the school's hand. I'm an involved parent in my son's education, but I do hold the school and the district accountable just for providing the tools and making sure the kids are in a safe environment.
So despite what happened to Aiden, you are now reluctantly sending your son back to the classroom after much consideration. How come?
Yes, it was truly a hard decision to come to. Ultimately, the winner was, I would have preferred Aiden to continue with distance learning. In the past years, he's excelled in his studies. His focus has improved. He's participating in class and showing effort. However, school does play a helping hand in social skills, and I'm trusting the promise of LAUSD and Cowan. You know, this year they're promoting and providing us with different protocols and ways to show that the school would take better actions in the student's education, and I'm trusting that that option is true. And if it's not, I can always revert back to remote learning. I just want to at least try it to see what's happening.
Sure. The LAUSD and teachers face, of course, more obligations now since they have to follow COVID protocols. Are you worried that your kids and other kids who are being bullied at school won't get the attention that they deserve?
You know, I anticipate the teachers managing a healthy learning environment with COVID. But like any other parent, I am worried. There's always going to be some worry or doubt in the back of my mind of what could happen. However, I do feel that separate to the COVID protocols, the mental and emotional concerns for the students, I feel like this year, the district is showing us that they're better prepared to take those into consideration as priorities.
Are there things that you might be looking out for that would change your mind?
Definitely another experience with a racially motivated experience like the one we experienced in second grade. That would definitely be a disappointment and a turn away because the focus is to get these students prepared, you know, and racial bias shouldn't be a concern of a fourth grader or any child of that nature. I am also I'm not too happy with the daily QR code. I don't know what the online system is, but I'm not too friendly with that.
We have been speaking with Britannia Hurst, whose son attends an LAUSD elementary school. Britannia, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Larry. I appreciate it.
Talk to us about your high school experience. Obviously, one of the top players in the country, started at Townsend Catholic, eventually moved on to Oak Hill. But what was your high school process
Hill.
Like? most NBA players in any school history.
Indeed.
Alumni.
Indeed. Oh, I mean, like, I went to a Catholic school. Right, so going to Catholic school, it was hard coming in there with braids, you know what I'm saying, from the projects, got to take two trains, a bus to get to school every morning, mm-hmm. you know, getting to school, however way you can get to school. And I was good, but I wasn't the top player in the country, mm-hmm. good. I was locally good. People knew me because I played in the streets, mm-hmm. and I played with my neighborhood. Wherever my neighborhood went, that's what we was playing. We played for money, whatever. Whoever you was, we was rocking mm-hmm. out. So when I got to Towson Catholic, I bought that with me. So by the time I get to my junior year, they kicked me out. You know, a lot of people don't know that I got kicked out of Towson Catholic my junior year because I had braids. They were just, you know, they was...
Too niggerish.
It was racism, you know what I'm saying? Yeah, and I didn't know that I was a part of the racism at that point in time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you walking around and, you know, the Monsignor and the archdiocese looking at you like, yo, well, you got to take your hair out. I'm like, nah, I can't do that. Right. You know what I'm saying? My tie was crooked. You got detention. Like, they was picking on me.
Looking for
so
anything.
By the time my junior year ended, I had so many detentions accumulated that I had to come back that summer in order to get my transcript, my report card. And I'm like, I'm done with that. Like, I ain't about to come in the summer and scrub tables and, you know, wash books. So I'm not, man, it's summertime, okay, yeah. man. So I got kicked out. They kicked me out. I had to go to summer school anyway. And then I ended up at Oak Hill, which really changed my whole life.
She goes channel to channel, phone looking for that hero. She watched Channel Zero.
Welcome to the internet. Here's an overview.
I guess the two first things that come to mind are kind of a safe haven and exclusivity, which are weirdly contradictory.
They love to argue. They love to say things. And other people don't like it when they say things.
Facebook and my little AOL account when I was 6 years old taught me don't give your name to strangers and don't give out your information. You know, just the basics of internet safety.
It was a lot of people who wanted two 40-year-old men to kiss a lot and write
fan fictions about how they're in the 50s and then one of them dies of cancer or something. Just very bizarre.
I can bring you community. I can bring you acceptance. I can bring you love.
The best experience I had online was meeting my boyfriend. I was 15 when I met my boyfriend, and we became really good friends right away. And that was almost 4 years ago now. We're still together, and now we're living together. So yeah, I would say that was a pretty positive experience in my life.
I ended up making like friends on there with a couple of people who were like really, really nice and kind and like sweet people that actually ended up like helping me out like a lot.
Because I've been able to find, you know, other people who are non-binary, other people who are people of color, other people who are like me in certain ways and also share my interests.
As a child, I always kind of figured, like, you know, I wasn't a little girl. I didn't refer to myself like that, but I just didn't have the terminology to refer to myself like as I really was. And it wasn't until I got on the internet that I started to learn these different terms and I learned how to define myself.
This is a thing that other people experience. That is like a thing and not just like some weird freak anomaly that I'm experiencing.
Some may say I bring discourse, arguments, and anxiety. But is that really my fault?
It's so exhausting being a minority on the internet. It just seems like every stupid thought that people have about minorities is being constantly thrown in my face.
It can be much more abrupt and being like, oh, your name is Jew Killer. That's a cool thing to see on my Friday afternoon trying to play a video game with my friends. Like,
there's no point in me trying to get into an argument with a racist on the internet because I know in the end I'm just going to be the one who ends up getting hurt.
Well, that's not a great look, I must admit. But I'm not all to blame. I am simply a resource, a tool to be used by others. I allow you to connect. How you choose to do that remains up to you.
I think my favorite part of the internet would be, I guess, being able to meet new people so easily, being able to connect with them on things that it would be so much harder to do in person. Like, you know, you could meet someone on a different continent.
That kind of connection, which I feel like is sort of the original point of the internet, is sharing information.
Like, I cracked open a coconut the other day because I didn't know how. And I looked up a YouTube video and I used a hammer and a screwdriver and it was rotten on the inside, but now I know how to do it.
There have been a lot of like online games I've played with very short-term interaction. Games where you are just like in a space with people you don't know and don't need to connect with. And people against all odds are positive. It's just a sweet thing. It's like, hey, let's have fun.
From Radioactive.
I'm Lucas Galarno. Thank you for listening to this Radioactive podcast. Thank you to my interview subjects, Freddie Frogman, Jackson Costello, Teo Lee, and Finch Caudill-Simon. And thank you to my mentor, Sonia Harris, and my editor, Leela Lakehart.
Okay, my favorite social media is going outside on a walk. That's my answer.
New York, New York, a hell of a town. The Bronx is hot, but the battery's down. The people ride around in a hole in the ground. New York, New York, it's a hell of a town.
So as of yesterday in New York City, if you are 12 or older, you will be required to show proof of having received at least one dose of a COVID-19 vaccine in order to participate in a host of in-person activities. That goes for workers, too. The proof of vaccine to enter requirement, dubbed the key to New York City, will apply to indoor restaurants, bars, museums, and movie theaters, but not to places such as office buildings, community centers, and senior centers. And again, this is by and large an indoor activities mandate. It does not apply to outdoor dining areas, though I see it will apply to the city's so-called homecoming concerts this week, which are outdoor events, vaccine mandate. On September 13th, the city will begin issuing fines, $1,000 for a first offense and $2,000 for a second, to indoor businesses that fail to ensure that their venues are off limits to those who remain unvaccinated. With me now to talk more about what the mandate means and to take your calls on day one yesterday of this experience is Caroline Lewis, freelance journalist and frequent contributor to Gothamist and WNYC on matters of health. Hi, Caroline. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks, Brian.
So, Caroline, maybe we should go over the basics, because prior to this week, the mayor said that the vaccine requirements would apply to indoor dining and bars and gyms and performance spaces, but on Monday he broadened the list. So what's really in?
So it really does apply to most indoor spaces that people would be in for an extended period of time, you know, everything from nightclubs to pool halls, concert venues, you know, indoor pools, museums and galleries. So, you know, these are sort of small spaces like a coffee shop to also like a big restaurant or a fast food joint. You know, it really applies to most spaces that people would go in indoors in the city.
And which venues are exempt from the executive order?
So it does exempt residential and office buildings, as well as churches, community centers, and schools. And also, you know, if someone is just going into a store for retail or popping into a restaurant to pick up a takeout order or use the bathroom, they won't have to show their vaccine card. So it's really if they're going to be staying for a while.
Hair salons, beauty parlors?
I don't think those are on the list. I know that I have to double check, but I don't think those are on the list. But I know that, you know, a gym, fitness class, you know, things like that, movie theaters, those are all included.
Yeah, I think hair salons and beauty parlors are not on the list. No vaccine proof required there, as I understand it. But let's just touch on movie theaters, which you mentioned, for a second, because the mayor was on here a couple of weeks ago when the original list came out, and even he was almost surprised when I raised movie theaters as an exemption at that time. Like, if you're going to see live theater, you needed to show proof of a vaccine, but not if you're going to sit in a movie theater, which in many ways is a similar exposure experience. And he said, yeah, we have to take a look at that again. So for people who thought movie theaters were out of this requirement, movie theaters are now in, right?
Right. That's right. I think it's a much more extensive list than maybe people were anticipating.
And why museums?
I mean, I think the idea is that if you are spending an extended amount of time indoors in close proximity to other people, then it should be on the list. That seems to be sort of the logic behind the places that are included.
I think when museums originally reopened after the first phase of COVID, they were arguing that they could space people, unlike in a theater, let's say, only let a certain number of people in at a time or a certain number of people into a gallery at a time. But museums are now included in the vaccine mandate. What verification documents are being accepted?
So people will have to show their ID along with proof of vaccination. And so that can be their, you know, CDC vaccine card, or it can be a picture of the card, either, you know, a physical picture or a digital picture on their phone. And people can also use the Excelsior Pass app from the state to show proof of vaccination, or the NYC COVID Safe app, which also is basically just, you know, an app for storing a picture of your vaccine proof. And then if you are not from, if you weren't vaccinated in the U.S., you can show an immunization record from outside of the U.S. that shows, you know, your name, the name of the vaccine, when you were vaccinated, all that sort of basic information. And there is a list of vaccines that are accepted outside of the ones that are authorized in the U.S., which is basically vaccines that were authorized by the World Health Organization.
And I want to reinforce for a second one of the things you just said, which is that you not only need proof of vaccination, you need a valid ID. I've told the story before, but I actually went to a Yankee game back in May when they were still requiring proof of vaccination or a negative COVID test and your ID to go to outdoor ball games. And the person in front of me online had a proof of vaccination card, but they didn't have an ID that showed that they matched up with it, and they were turned away. So proof of ID, don't forget that along with whatever proof of vaccination you're using, right?
Absolutely. The ID is crucial in this situation.
Proof of negative COVID tests. Again, I know we said it, but let's just be really clear, because this is different than some of the workplace requirements for office workers in the city and other people. Proof of negative COVID tests cannot be used in place of proof of vaccines for these venues that we're talking about, bars, restaurants, museums, movie theaters, etc.
That's right. And I think it's also going to be interesting to see which places require, you know, proof of vaccination, because there's a lot of places that like have indoor and outdoor sections, and the proof of vaccination is really only required if you're going to be in an indoor section, but it can get confusing. Like if there's a bar with indoor and outdoor seating, like are staff going to be able to keep track of who's going where, and, you know, will they instead just check proof for everyone going in? You know, I think it's going to be interesting how it's implemented.
Question via Twitter. Listener says, it's so easy to make fraudulent cards, it's almost ridiculous to permit them as proof. Well, it's a statement, not a question. But the implied question is it that easy? And are people gaming the system already?
There has been, reports of people creating fraudulent cards. It is definitely against the law. The state did try to pass a new bill sort of making it clear that it's against the law and emphasizing that, which passed the legislature but wasn't signed by the governor. But there is, FBI already said earlier this year that it's a federal infraction to, create a fraudulent CDC card. And then if you're using, say, the Excelsior app, which doesn't have a CDC seal, that may not be covered by that. But I think it would still fall under the state forgery law, which, if you forge a written document, either digital or, physical, that could be punishable by up to 7 years in prison if it's classified as a Class D felony. So
one listener says on Twitter, I was happy to go out for dinner last night knowing that I would be surrounded by vaccinated customers, but I was not asked for proof. Another one writes, I personally won't feel any more safe if children under 12 are permitted into indoor venues. Let's take each of those. If people weren't asked for proof yesterday on day one, they're not enforcing this until mid-September. Is that likely why they wouldn't have been asked for proof last night at a restaurant?
Well, I think if a restaurant or, a venue wants to comply with this, they should already be complying because it's already taken effect. But there may be some adjustment period. It may be that some places don't have the staffing to do it or the protocols set up yet. And so maybe there's an adjustment period. I guess that's why they are delaying enforcement.
And to the listener who wrote, I personally won't feel any more safe if children under 12 are permitted into indoor venues. And obviously that's because there are no vaccines for children under 12 yet. How are people supposed to deal with that?
Well, children under 12 are going to be required to wear a mask unless they are eating or drinking. So I guess that's, supposed to mitigate the potential spread. And so, it's sort of, I mean, I guess, you know, it's a trade-off. Like, obviously, it would be a much bigger burden if people couldn't go out to dinner with their children anymore.
By the way, how does proof of ID along with proof of vaccination work for a 12-year-old? Somebody else tweets saying not many have picture ID, not many 12-year-olds.
I guess they should be allowed to show a school ID. I think in general, you can use any, ID that has, a picture and your name. But that's a good question. If there isn't an ID available, maybe it's something that schools will have to take up.
Another listener tweets, a friend and I went to Lavender Lake in Gowanus for dinner and drinks last night. Little plug there by this listener, I guess, for one of their haunts. And it says we had to show our card and Vax ID. We ate outside, but it was still good to know everyone around us had to show the proof. But again, to be clear, you don't have to show it to eat outdoors, correct?
That's right. But I actually had a similar experience. I went to a place in Brooklyn where there's like a tacos outside and you can sit outside. But if you want to go to the bar, you have to go inside to get a drink. And, in my mind, that sort of falls under the exemption of a quick and limited purpose if you're just running inside to get something or use the bathroom. But they were basically checking ID and vax proof for everybody and saying if you wanted to go inside for any reason, then you had to show it. And so I think that maybe there might just be some streamlining happening. But I think that people can say, what the rule is if a restaurant isn't really following it.
So you say go inside for any reason, which prompts the obvious question, what if an outdoor dining customer has to use the bathroom? Do they need to show proof of vaccination?
Right. So under the executive order, they don't need to show proof of vaccination. But like I said, in this bar that I was at, they were basically saying, if you don't want to show proof of vaccination, you just can't go inside and use the bathroom, which I think maybe there's just an adjustment period and everyone's familiarizing themselves with the rules. But officially, you do not have to show proof of vaccination to go inside just to use the bathroom.
But then there are other places that are vowing to resist. I saw on TV a little spot with a restaurant owner from a small space in South Brooklyn who says, no, I'm not going to do this. And if I tried to do it, my customers, some of them would revolt, and I don't want to get into those altercations. And they actually posted a sign outside that said, we do not discriminate based on vaccine status, mask status, all that stuff, to say discriminate, to put that in the same category as racial discrimination or gender or LGBT discrimination, to use the word discrimination, I think would be insulting to a lot of people. But that's the sign they posted. And there's going to be that kind of resistance at some places. Have you reported on anything like that yet? Or has the city said how they'll handle anything like that yet?
Well, it's definitely something I'm interested in. And, that's sort of the next step in reporting this story. I think I've heard discrimination used in a slightly different context in this case, where, some people are saying that the policy discriminates against businesses that primarily serve, populations that have lower vaccination rates. So, for instance, like businesses with, primarily Black clientele in zip codes that, are less vaccinated, because, I think only like 38% of Black people have at least one vaccine dose in the city. And, if a business's clientele or a cultural organization's clientele really are not that vaccinated, they could be, more impacted negatively by this mandate. Of course, some might still feel that it's making them safer. And the mayor, when he was asked about this on Monday, definitely said, if anything, we're trying to keep everybody safe, so it's not discrimination. But I think there is that question of how some businesses might be impacted differently than others.
White supremacy is the sickness.
Students returned to school in a number of states this week amid a new surge of COVID cases and a fierce battle over face masks in the classroom. Republican governors in states like Arizona and Texas have tried to stop school districts from mandating masks. That has drawn sharp criticism from some parents and educators, and even action from the White House. John Yang reports from Florida, the epicenter of this debate.
It's the first week of school for Luca Moreno Ramos, a first grader in Broward County, Florida.
Our heroes are about to find out.
After the better part of a year spent learning virtually away from friends and teachers, he's eager to get back in the classroom. Luca's dad, John, makes sure he has a new back-to-school necessity, a face mask. The Broward County School District, with more than 260,000 students, the nation's sixth largest, began the school year with a requirement that all students and teachers wear a mask indoors unless they have a doctor's note.
I think that, you know, little kids that have been really exposed to what is happening and their parents talk to them about what is going on, they don't have any issues. Luca has never told me, like, I don't want to have this on.
Across town, Kelly Doyle's 14-year-old son, Ben, was nervous the morning of his first day of high school, and he said wearing a mask didn't help.
I think it's just annoying, honestly. Like, it just gets in the way. It's harder to breathe. It gets warm.
It really isn't doing anything, and it's more of a detriment to the kids because it's not a healthy thing to have a mask on all day. You know, at what point do people need to stop being responsible for someone else's health, and they need to start being responsible for their own health?
Earlier this month, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommended that all those in schools wear a mask.
How important is masking?
Masking is critical.
Dr. Lisa Gwynn is a University of Miami pediatrician and president of the Florida chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. She says there is no evidence that masks are harmful to children.
The sources of the CDC and all of the science-based professional organizations in medicine all agree. And so, you know, that's all I can say about that.
In Florida, the disagreement among parents over masking in schools has become a political fight. Days after the Broward County School Board imposed the mask mandate last month, Republican Governor Ron DeSantis issued an executive order effectively banning local school districts from requiring masks. He said it was a matter of parental freedom of choice.
What right do you have to deny my child an education because of a mask?
My daughter's life depends on each and every one of you.
But last week, after hours of impassioned testimony from both sides, the board voted to keep the mandate. Board Chair Rosalind Osgood.
We believe strongly that it's not about defying the governor. It's a moral decision that says we value the life of people no matter what. We do whatever it is we need to do to protect them.
Now, the Broward County School District is being threatened with penalties for its mask mandate. The State Board of Education says it may withhold the amount of money the district spends on the salaries of the superintendent and the members of the school board.
I'm willing personally to give up my salary if I have to for that year, because I'll be able to sleep at night knowing that I did everything I could to protect a child or staff person in a school.
This week, Florida's largest district, Miami-Dade, said it too would require all students and teachers to be masked when classes start on Monday.
If it saves one life, 10 hospitalizations, isn't that the least that we can do?
And in Hillsborough County, which includes Tampa, officials imposed a 30-day mask mandate after more than 1,000 students tested positive for COVID in the first week of school. Since the start of July, COVID cases have been surging across Florida, including, notably, among children. For parents like Jenna Haig, a school mask mandate isn't the answer. The day before classes began, Haig took her 10-year-old daughter Addison to a meet the teacher open house.
She's not wearing a mask.
Well, then she's not going to come to school.
That's fine.
They were turned away after refusing to put on masks.
In my eyes, for me, it's not time for my child to wear one for 8 hours a day. It's just too long.
Addison said wearing a mask in classes last school year gave her headaches.
I hated it. It always, like, made me sweaty because it was on my face all day, and you couldn't take it off.
So Addison wasn't in school when classes began. Now Haig, who's running for the Florida legislature, has applied for a state school voucher program Governor DeSantis is using for students who don't want to comply with any local district's mask mandate.
I'm not saying that if somebody else chooses to send their child with a mask, that that shouldn't be allowed. It should. That's their choice. That's their prerogative, as it is mine to make that decision for my child. And, you know, it's not the school board that gets to make that decision.
On the first day of school, Broward officials reported near universal compliance with the mask mandate. For longtime high school teacher Katrina Whitaker, it was a relief.
I wanted to do a cartwheel, I wanted to do a flip, I wanted to do a split. I was happy, and I was happy that I didn't have to say to the kids, put on your mask. They were walking around with their mask on. It's just great to know that they care enough to put on their mask. And this is Janice.
Whitaker, who lost a close colleague to COVID last week, said teachers have been forgotten in this debate.
I don't think that they value what the teachers want. You know, we have not been asked what we want, how we feel about it.
For now, John Moreno Escobar is sending his son Luca to school with a sense of relief.
They made a decision to protect our kids, to protect our teachers, to protect our community as a whole. And, you know, it's something really simple. You know, just wear your mask, make sure that your kids wearing their mask when they go to school, and that's it.
Across town, Kelly Doyle finds herself in a game of wait and see.
Have a good day. If this goes on for a month, you know, I'll have to see how I feel again. I don't want to pull him out of school. You know, it's a tough call.
As families, school administrators, and public health officials clash over the best way for schools to reopen safely. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm John Yang in Broward County, Florida.
The stars at night are big and bright.
Where does that happen, Ray?
Deep in the heart of Texas.
Hey, Don, a change of subject, but a subject you and I have discussed on this broadcast, and that is the pandemic. The following took place. It happened last night. It aired last night. I've been wanting to talk to you about it today. Here is the Lieutenant Governor of Texas.
The COVID is spreading, particularly most of the numbers are with the unvaccinated, and the Democrats like to blame Republicans on that. Well, the biggest group in most states are African-Americans who have not been vaccinated. The last time I checked, over 90% of them vote for Democrats in their major cities and major counties.
Don, have at it.
I'm going to do my best to have at it without cussing, B. Will. So, first of all, African-Americans are about 13% of the population in Texas. So statistically, if there is a COVID spread, which apparently there is in Texas, apparently, according to the lieutenant governor, it has nothing to do with failure to mask up or anti-mask policies, but it has something to do with Black folks, who are a substantial minority of the population, well behind white folks and well behind Latinos in the state. So you see how statistics lie here. Second of all, it's easy to spout such statistics without pointing out a very real and very painful history of the United States, the American medical system, intentionally using Black bodies as essentially guinea pigs and lab rats. Of course, we've heard the terms Tuskegee, but we're talking about forced sterilization and eugenics and brain experiments throughout the American South. We're talking about Black maternal health, in which African-American women's pain complaints are still not taken seriously. And you see Black maternal mortality at a substantially higher rate than their white counterparts. So when we're talking about African-American vaccine hesitancy, and yes, we are substantially behind white counterparts in terms of vaccine adoption, that is because it doesn't turn off overnight. A very real and very recent history of American medical malfeasance, intentional and sometimes just neglectful malfeasance toward Black bodies, it doesn't turn off just because we're trying to save ourselves from a global pandemic. So if Dan Patrick had any sense, he would be using his platform as an elected leader in the state of Texas to invest in communications and resources and talking to and defeating disinformation in African-American communities instead of blaming the miner's canary. Of course, that's a literary reference, which he probably wouldn't understand. But ultimately, this is the same guy who told us we should sacrifice our grandmothers and grandfathers because being old and dying in a pandemic ain't the worst thing. He said that just a year ago. So Dan Patrick is a moron. And in the words of my dad, he could probably get somewhere and sit his ass down.
See, it used to be we could beat up minorities and nobody cared. It's the reason a lot of us joined the force. Hey, Mitch, you want to go down and arrest some homeless people but not be able to beat up any minorities? No, thank you. Yeah, no, I think we're good.
This is KNKX. It's been more than 2 months since three Tacoma police officers were charged with felonies in the killing of Manuel Ellis. Ellis, who was black, died after repeatedly telling officers he could not breathe as they restrained him. Officers Matthew Collins, Christopher Burbank, and Timothy Rankin have pleaded not guilty. They all remain employed by the Tacoma Police Department, pending the results of an internal investigation. KNKX's Kari Plogue and Patrick Malone with the Seattle Times have partnered on coverage of the Ellis case, and they talked about the latest developments. Patrick, you just published a story detailing the local law enforcement response to the charges. What did you uncover in your reporting?
Well, we started by analyzing Tacoma Police Department attendance data that showed on the date that the charges were announced that absences were 30% higher than average, and in fact, nearly a third of the entire force took that day off. An important development in the case came the day after the charges were filed. That's when Josh Harris, the owner of Integrity Construction Group in Tacoma, bailed out the officers by posting their $300,000 bond. Harris told Como News he was inspired to bail out the officers to show his support for law enforcement and also to recognize the three defendants' military service. But the Tacoma Action Collective, community organizers and allies of the Ellis family, unearthed a connection Harris had failed to mention. Harris's brother is the Tacoma Police Department's chaplain. Tacoma Action Collective spread the word online, and a lot of emotion poured out on social media from Ellis's family and its supporters, as well as the officers' backers. A school security officer who'd posted her support for the officers and Harris on Facebook really didn't like Ellis's sister's online response to her post. It told people where they could complain to the officer's supervisors, and this officer turned around and sought a protection order against Ellis's sister. A judge ultimately ruled that the school security officer couldn't expect greater protection under the First Amendment than Ellis's sister could and denied the order.
And Kari, you recently spoke with Ellis's sister, Monet Carter Mixon, about what she's been dealing with since the officers were charged. What did she have to say?
Yeah, so beyond the stress that was brought on by the restraining order that Patrick mentions, Monet says that a lot happened within the week of the charging decision. She says that she was harassed by someone in her neighborhood. She had her car vandalized. She believes that someone's been following her for the past 2 months. So she actually moved her family to a temporary location as a precaution. And she suspects that all of this is directly related to how vocal she's been about her brother's case.
I'm checking my car before I actually get into it, like having to basically have like a bunch of safety precautions. I wasn't having to do that before because now people are desperate. You know, they are facing like serious charges, but I just feel like they want to intimidate me to make me maybe be more fearful about speaking out or saying things. I hope they know that I'm not going to like stop.
Monet also told me that she's having some pretty serious conversations with her kids about all that's been going on.
My oldest son was the one that said, "Mom, like, they could come in and like just kill you and say that you were associated with whatever, did whatever, make whatever they want to make up about you and kill you in front of us. I could say that there was no reason for them to do that, but they're going to be believed by they, law enforcement, police officers, whoever. They could do that, and you would be gone."
Monet says that she understands that sounds extreme, but to her and her family, it's not hyperbole. She says she doesn't trust law enforcement to protect her while this case plays out in court.
Patrick, why does all of this matter, especially as it relates to your reporting on the law enforcement response?
Well, police in Washington state just aren't accustomed to facing criminal charges when they kill someone on duty. The three officers charged for killing Manuel Ellis matched the statewide total over the previous 40 years, and it's even rarer in Pierce County and Tacoma. So law enforcement and its supporters have reacted as though they've been betrayed by a justice system that they trusted to justify every death. For Ellis's sister, Monet, it's just also been an eye-opening and unfamiliar experience to be invited into the rarefied air of the criminal justice system, especially as a victim of police violence. Her experience beating back a restraining order that could have brought police officers from the same department as the officers that killed her brother at a moment's notice just made her feel less safe now than she did before the officers were charged.
And, Kari, the family has already been through a lot, and this case is far from over. What's next for Monet?
So despite all that she's been dealing with, Monet told me that she's trying her best to focus on the joy in her life right now. She's actually expecting another baby soon, a son, her sixth baby, and she's naming him after Manny.
So I don't know. I feel like maybe he was like, he was brought to me or given to me like by like my brother to kind of like keep him around or keep him with me. Like I have a little piece of him on earth. So he's all my kids are special, but he's like a little bit special, a little bit more special.
Monet's pregnancy is actually considered a high risk pregnancy. She says right now she's trying to take it easy so she can deliver a healthy baby. And she says that means thinking about the happy memories that she has of her brother.
All right, Kari, Patrick, thank you both for your reporting.
Thanks.
Thank you.
That was KNKX's Kari Ploeg and Patrick Malone of the Seattle Times. You can find out more about this story, including a link to the Seattle Times investigation, at our website, knkx.org.
We're being haunted every day. It's a silent war against African-American people as a whole.
The hunt is on. And you're the prey.
An Orangeville mother claims she was brutally beaten in front of her own father and young children by Solano County Sheriff's deputies last year. Now a civil rights lawsuit has been filed against the law enforcement agency and some of its deputies.
And that police body camera video was released by the family's attorney. ABC 10's Kurt Rivera shows us more.
In edited video from the family's attorney, the Solano County Sheriff's body cam video begins by showing an SUV pulling off the road near Dixon, August of last year. From the driver's side exits 33-year-old Nakia Porter. The software engineer says she wanted to switch driving duties with her father, J.B. Powell. Along with her 3- and 4-year-old daughters and a 6-year-old niece, the family was returning to Orangevale from a museum trip to Oakland.
For you to be beaten down as you were less than a human being.
You know what? Detain Paul.
It so happened a sheriff's vehicle was parked nearby, and the two deputies approached Porter. After she motioned and communicated what she was doing, you see the deputies with at least one gun drawn handcuff her anyways and tell her the reason for detaining her.
You have two different plates on your vehicle.
She is then pulled away from her car, questions the deputies as to why, and then a struggle ensues. With the camera shaking, it's hard to see what's going on. But Porter's attorney makes it clear what he says happened.
Kicking, kneeing her, striking her in the back of the neck, the head, the face.
Her attorney says Porter became unconscious for over 5 minutes and dragged to the patrol car by the deputy. The lawsuit claims deputies lied about Porter fighting and about the time she was unconscious to paramedics on scene.
She went out. Yeah, no more than 20 seconds.
We did not deserve this. We did nothing wrong.
Porter was jailed for 6 hours on suspicion of resisting arrest, but never charged. A call for comment to the Solano County Sheriff's Office was not returned.
Now it doesn't matter now. It really doesn't matter what happens now. I left Atlanta this morning, and as we got started on the plane, there were 6 of us. The pilot said over the public address system, we are sorry for the delay. But we have Dr. Martin Luther King on the plane. And to be sure that all of the bags were checked. And to be sure that nothing would be wrong on the plane, we had to check out everything carefully. And we've had the plane protected and guarded all night. And then I got into Memphis. And some began to say the threats, or talk about the threats that were out. Or what would happen to me from some of our sick white brothers.
Hey guys, so Hall family says that they forgave the young man who shot at their house and then some. They say they harbor no ill will against him and want to put what happened behind them. Take a look.
We just trying to move on from here, right. You know, yet the memory will still always be there. But as adults and with our kids, we have to move on.
And after nearly a year, The Hall family finally can. The man who terrorized them over several days will spend more than 1,000 of them in prison. A Macomb County Circuit Court judge gave Michael Frederick Jr. a sentence of 4 to 10 years Monday. The 25-year-old shot at the Hall family's home, slashed tires on one of their cars, and wrote racist graffiti on their pickup truck last September. He told the judge he did it all because he was incensed over the Hall's Black Lives Matter sign.
You should respect people for who they are. And just go on. Okay, you got your viewpoint, I got my viewpoint. Let's agree to disagree.
Frederick's targeting of the Warren family struck a nerve. It happened as communities were already on edge as protests broke out around the country following the murder of George Floyd and the contentious election between then-President Donald Trump and former VP Joe Biden. As Warren police worked to find and arrest Frederick,
Black lives, they matter here.
There were marches in support of the Halls and counter-protests. But despite all that happened, the Halls are extending an olive branch to Frederick.
I'm not angry. I'm forgiving. I'm loving. I care about this kid. I want to see, you know, I even looked at him and I told him, I said, you're a great kid. You have great things coming your way. You know, you made a bad mistake, you know, but I want you to learn. And in my impact statement, it said, I want you to get close to God.
And he did.
Wow! Hey, yo, drama, hold up, sir. Hold on. Stop the motherfucking record.
All right.
I want you to Pondy replay, drama. Pondy replay. Let's give him one more chance, man. Run that shit the fuck back.
I'm not angry. I'm forgiving. I'm loving. I care about this kid. I want to see, you know, I even looked at him and I told him, I said, you're a great kid. You have great things coming your way. You know, you made a bad mistake, you know, but I want you to learn. And in my impact statement, it said, I want you to get close to God.
And he did.
And he said that.
Frederick's father was charged with accessory after the fact and evidence tampering for throwing the gun his son used into a river. He cut a deal with prosecutors to avoid serious jail time, but was ordered to pay $3,000 in restitution. The Hall say Frederick's actions ultimately backfired and unified their neighborhood.
What was meant for our harm, God turned it for our good. And I say that because neighbors came out of their houses, ones that we didn't see before, you know, and we were able to meet the people. We saw more love than hate in this whole thing. There was more people that came to our rescue, came to see about us.
Frederick also vandalized another home in the area that had a Joe Biden sign up on the property. The Hall say they want to stay in contact with Frederick as he serves his prison sentence.
This question, why is this stuff happening? The New York Times editorial today. The Trump effect. See, this is what I'm doing with my money, buying newspapers like Dick Gregory. The Trump effect and how it spreads. It says we are on the brink, under Trump, on the brink of fascism. New York Times, all the news that's fit to print, editorial 1210-2015. I say fascism is end-stage white supremacy. See, it's, I mean, just like in Nazi Germany. Fascism, system of racism, white supremacy, determined to survive.
And we are getting new images now of that truck Roseberry was parked in and his surrender to police. Thankfully, a peaceful end to the standoff, but we're still looking into the suspect's background to learn more about his motivations. Fox 46 Chief Investigative Reporter Jody Barr joins us now in the newsroom. And Jody, Roseberry was busy in that truck posting videos, giving long-winded speeches. So what do those videos tell you about the suspect?
Well, Lindsay, Ray Roseberry left North Carolina this morning and fired up Facebook Live and took the entire internet along for what he called his revolution. Roseberry claimed to have a bomb, ammonium nitrate, and a ton of coins that he planned to use to blow up two blocks of the nation's capital.
Clear the air! Clear the air!
Ray Roseberry drove up onto the sidewalk in front of the Library of Congress, just yards away from the back of the U.S. Capitol.
These people think I'm joking, don't they?
Hey, man, will you call them? I've called 911 and told them to come out here and clear this place out. They need to clear it out because I got a bomb in here. I don't want nobody hurt.
I can't set this bomb off.
Roseberry had this in his lap. He says it was a 2.5-pound bomb. He claims he made 3 calls to 911.
Well, finally got a little notice. God finally got some notice.
But it took nearly 10 minutes before anyone showed up. Roseberry claimed the detonator works off spikes in decibels. Roseberry warned any loud noises, like a gunshot, would set it off.
Works off decibels. Y'all see that little round thing? I know you're watching me. This little round thing right here is speakers.
Roseberry claimed in the recordings that 4 others also planted bombs around D.C. today, but he didn't know where.
But you don't want to shoot these windows out, I'm telling you. The boys over on top of that roof, you don't want to shoot these windows out. When you shoot these windows out, the revolution is on even harder. There's going to be 4 more going off across this town.
Roseberry says his bomb plot was the beginning of an American patriot revolution. His rantings mentioned grievances against veteran care, illegal immigration, lack of health insurance, and the way the U.S. withdrew from Afghanistan, turning the country over to the Taliban.
This ain't about politics. I think y'all Democrats need to step down. I'll die in federal prison. You step down out of office, I'll step down out of this truck. You go home, I'll go to federal prison.
Ray Roseberry surrendered about an hour into his revolution. He's now in the custody of the federal government. Ray Roseberry got emotional during those Facebook lives when talking about the love for his country and his wife, who he promised he'd be home back to by Sunday. If convicted of the charges that are likely to come in this bomb plot, Roseberry likely will never see home again. Lindsay.
All right, Jody Barr, an ongoing investigation right now, and it's been an eventful afternoon regarding this incident for sure. There's still a lot to learn about the suspect and what led up to Roseberry parking his truck outside the Library of Congress. Be sure to stay with Fox 46 on air and online as we learn more about him and the device he was carrying.
Miriam I. Carey, context of white supremacy, Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, August 21, 2021. So I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have thoughts, observations, suggestions, counter-racist thoughts. The number 720-716-7300. The code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. That number again, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. I made an error. We're supposed to be doing our Global Sunday Talk last Sunday, third Sunday of the month. We are doing it tomorrow to make up, so we'll be here 3 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Central, 12 noon Pacific. And quite a few things have happened. Obviously, we have the whole situation in Afghanistan and so-called U.S. withdrawal, whatever that means. The situation in Haiti, or everything that's happening in the area of the world known as Haiti right now. Obviously, the COVID situation and just trying to get an update on that. Lots of things to discuss within a global context. So that will be tomorrow. Should have been last week, but better a week delayed than never. We are listener-supported counter-racist radio. Invest if you think the cows is constructive. You can hit the blog racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. Much obliged to all the folks who have invested, kept us on the air through the entirety of the Rona, when people could have been investing in toilet paper or corn dogs, water filtration, bullets, variety of things. Booster shots. Folks have still supported in the cows. I hope we have contributed constructive, accurate information about what racism, white supremacy is, how it works, and things that victims, non-white people, can and should be doing to solve this problem immediately. Cash App should be linked. It is cash.app/$thecows. We are also on Amazon. You can hit my wish list, Gusty Renegade, how it is listed. Much obliged again to all of the many investors all over the planet who have nabbed items and invested in the cows. I hope we have remained worthy of your time and energy for 12 plus years. A baker's dozen for sure. Metaphor. Let's see. Some of the many things that took place. Wow. Many things. Let's see. They had the report at the beginning. That was from Seattle Public Radio. Adar Abdi, black female, teen. She talked about how she reads so much fantasy. I thought that's important because we've heard. I do not have children. We've talked to a number of attempted parents over the years, and they've said that, you know, it's intimidating to speak with young folks, even their offspring, about racism, white supremacy, because you don't quite know the words or how to broach. Are they going to be able to understand? And it's been my experience repeatedly. I think there's some evidence with Justice and her brilliant tenure as a adolescent child and asking questions on the cows. But I think, you know, if you have a child, they're healthy, they're paying attention to things, they're observant, their brain computer will allow them to process racism, white supremacy, what it is, how it works. And in fact, we've heard a number of parents and even folks where they were talking about, like, they had nephews or nieces or younger cousins type of a thing, and they had not, like, been talking to them about racism or trying to, you know, force them to read Neely Fuller, nothing like that. And they would just sit down, everybody's friend, television. They would sit in front of a screen, and they would be exactly what you heard from Adar Abdi and her totally dissecting the racism, white supremacy in those fantasy stories. Why is every character that's beautiful white, fair? Blonde hair and blue. Why is that? And she said the converse, every evil, demonic, no count rascal of a character is dark. Now, what is that saying? Brilliant. Now, I also noted within that segment, now, gotta be, this is Seattle Public Radio, so we gotta have racist influence. They didn't say that this was racism. She came out, her first mention was sexism. Now, they didn't have one example of so-called sexism. Not one. Every example was racism. Why isn't that the number one thing said? Let's make that the priority. Don't, what they call it, don't bury the lead. No, we got to get sexism in there. Even though, again, not one illustration. All we heard was denigration of non-white people and praise of white. Anywho. Racism, and then they didn't just say sexism, racism. They said sexism, racism, or any other ism. Conflation, to totally confuse, have to say this all the time. This is deliberate racism, white supremacy, to even have a segment go out like that. This is not the young lady's fault. This is the white people at KUOW, Seattle Public Radio, and beyond. You know good and well, it's white supremacy, racism, and there's nothing else. There's lots of mistreatment on this planet. You don't go around and have an ism for people who get mistreated because they wear glasses, although that might be coming. You wouldn't say racism and four eyes ism. We'll call it that for now. Come up with a catchier title later. Have more time. You wouldn't say that because that's absurd. Like, what are you doing? Are you trying to belittle white supremacy, racism, or confuse people, a little of both? But they'll do that with sexism all the time. And the other isms to be named, maybe for I-ism too. POC, that's another one. People of color, non-white and white. Are we saying people of color and people of non-color? We got into this with Jane Elliott. It's total nonsense. Center the problem. White people, white, non-white. Let's see. Oh, and then the absurdity continues. So she gives all this, you know, how whiteness is there and all this, and the way that they degrade the darker people in these books. So they say, okay, well, how can we switch the story? It can't just be that we have a beautiful black person be the queen. No, no, no. To switch this totally up, now we got to have an alien. Now we got to make up somebody who, you know, has purple skin, or what do they do all the time? I don't care if they're polka dot and purple and all the rest. Now we just got to make up a total alien. If it can't be centered on white as beauty, it's got to be an alien. Can't center it on just a non-white person, a black person, and have them be beautiful and the center. Nah. We'll just talk about E.T. or something. Let's see. Next, they talked about, oh my goodness, the flights. I have been talking about this for a long time, just not on the air so much. I think the caller in Florida asked me about this maybe last week or so, in terms of what they're calling the verb, or the adjective I've seen most frequently is unruly. Unruly passenger behavior, you know, getting drunk. That's, oh. What, how did that moron, he says, sobriety would be best. Man, you can tell these folks are not cow's listeners. So many of these unruly passengers having a few drinks before getting on the flight, or having several drinks already on the plane, or both, and who knows what other fentanyl and other drugs that they got, dog food, opioid, right? It's been so many of these incidents. Cal's investor even sent me a report. It was, they said, a teenage class, a gang of teenage Jewish girls. You're not the boss of me. You're not going to tell me to wear a mask. Yeah, that's right. Sexism. That's what they say. And it's been several. It's not even the only one where I've seen where it was an entire class of white children, teens. You're not the boss of me. Tell me to wear a mask. Get out of here. I have just concluded no flying this year. Like I said, I was a little ignorant, been retarded by this system. And I was briefly looking at, you know, oh man, maybe I could get it. No going anywhere. COVID-19 and all the rest of it. But racist man, racist woman, racist child. Again, you can attribute this, in my view, white genetic annihilation and a number of other factors. But wow, the conduct has been so violent and unruly. They had to duct tape a passenger down. There is no way. In addition, you heard in the segment, they've had flight cancellations. Now, I've even my own theory on this, and I think some of the reports, American Airlines and some of the other airlines, they furloughed staff when everything shut down and nobody was flying, right? A lot of those folks didn't take those jobs back. So many, as they were talking about, they've had a lot of staff shortages. So they've had to cancel a lot of planes. There's been a lot of reports of that, too. People being stuck at the airport and white people sobbing and all the rest and getting on television. And I mean, many reasons. I would not fly this year if you absolutely have to. I know we have some folks, students, and you might have to travel literally thousands of miles to get back to your residence, or maybe even you are abroad, as they say, out of the country. Plan in advance. My suggestion would be get a non-stop ticket and leave early in the morning. Reason being, leave early in the morning. At least it's been my experience, and I have flown since the whole COVID thing. It's been my experience. You fly, when I say early, like 6 a.m., no later than 7, early as possible. It's been my experience. There are way fewer people in the airport in general and on any given flight. Generally, it doesn't mean sometimes you won't have a kind of full one depending on where you're going, but just in general, fewer people in the airport, you'll be able to get through screening and all that stuff much faster. It'll be less traffic getting to the airport. No connects. It's going to be a nonstop flight. And that early, not saying everybody, but you will at least minimize the drunken passenger number. Most people, not all, but most people 6 a.m. flight or what have you, they're just getting up. They haven't had enough time to get in a few brewskis or shots or whatever else it is. And it's so early that still even a significant number of people, they're going to go to sleep, Gusty included, when they get on the plane. They're going to sleep for a little while. So you can at least minimize the number of people who are, you know, under the influence, and even minimize some of the time that they're under the influence, because it'll be so early in the morning. At least that's the logic. But I would really, what, the train is beautiful. I took the train. I'm not just talking nonsense here. I took the train from Seattle, Washington to La Crosse, Wisconsin. It's in the Cows Archives there and back. It took about 2 days. It was beautiful. Outlet was on the train, had my computer. Psh, great. No problem. No problem. Take some books. You got your computer. You can have it all. Watch some movies. Listen to some counter-racist material. Read a little bit. Write a little bit. No big sleep a lot. And it's on the, I mean, you have much more room. You can get up, walk around and all that. Like, yeah, take the train. Do any. I would not recommend flying. There have been so many problems. It's been so unruly. I would really avoid it. And this even means, if we have any Cows listeners, if you're still doing, you know, White Jesus' birthday and all the nonsense that is really, as they say, right around the corner, I would say in advance, if I have to fly to attend any of these events, I'm not going to be present. I would say that now. I'm not flying for the rest of this year. I have no idea what's going to happen with the COVID situation. I have no idea what's going to happen with staffing, safety. I'm not fighting over people, over masks. It's been like this already. It's normally unruly and crazy when it's White Jesus birthday time and you got the airport full and all that. I flew from Florida on January 1, 2020. I can't believe that was only like a year and a half ago, but the line stretched all the way through the airport in Orlando. It was amazing. That's pre-COVID-19. You will have people, some folks who say, hey, we missed out last year, we got to do it up this year. Psh, sacrifices would have to be made. Safety is an important priority. I would say right now, adjust. If it's something where you can drive, it's that close, great. Or you can schedule in advance to drive or take the train or whatever. But I would not fly for any reason this year. If it's a sudden emergency, or like I said, something where you absolutely have to do this, AM flight, no connects. This is nonstop, early as possible. Get out of there. Sobriety would be best. Let's see. Next. they had the segment where the Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, suspected race soldier, where he blamed the black people. Now, our caller in Florida had said unvaccinated. He said, hey, the unvaccinated folks, the bulk of them. Oh, yeah, they're the black people. Old Democrat voting black people. That's who we're talking about. Lieutenant Governor. Now, the folks, they brought on Don Calloway, who was a black male victim of racism, white supremacy. White people brought him on to speak. They even started the segment and said, I wanted to hear your view. And they will do that a lot. They'll get a segment that's on racism, white supremacy. The Young Turks will do this. They don't even have black people on the show normally, but if something about racism happens, they'll often have a segment and they'll wheel out their black person, literally, to come talk for a few minutes, normally saying something incorrect. They do this on Bill Maher did this as well. He had a whole segment where he had W. Kamau Bell, Cowbell. He had him on and something had happened relating to racism. And he wanted to go to W. Kamau Bell first to get his thoughts on it. Let's get the Negro perspective from the Negro we've invited, type of a thing. They'll do this all the time. So they bring on Don Calloway. And he name calls Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, calls him a moron. And then he uses this literary metaphor and he says, oh, Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, he doesn't even know the literary reference that I'm making here. The canary in the coal mine. And he says, he said that he needs to, as my father would say, he needs to go and sit his behind down, using different language. Now, the first thing that came to mind, I think Governor Abbott in Texas has the Rona, unless I'm misinformed. I saw that this week, and I think he's been vaccinated, what they call the breakthrough. So if something were to happen, Lieutenant Governor would not have to go sit his rear down. He might be in line for succession. I don't know if he's number one to take Governor Abbott's place should he succumb to the Rona. I'm not wishing that or anything. I think that's what they call it, line of succession. So he would not be going to sit his hind parts down. Number two, I find that to be a really sophisticated act of racial showcasing and really racism, white supremacy, to kind of project this emotional black person who's name calling a white person. Yeah, I'm checking him. And importantly, suggesting that this is a dumb white person. I don't care what he said about sacrificing old people and if he's one of those anti-vaxxers and all of that. This is not a dumb white person. I'm very resistant to any suggestion that a white person who might be practicing racism, white supremacy, is dumb. Years of terrorism and domination over the entire known universe is not the product of ignorance. Just trying to use logic. But I think that's really, again, the people who are most to blame are white people because they invited Don Callaway on. They could have picked anybody to come on and say a word or two about what the Lieutenant Governor of Texas had to say. They sought out Don Callaway, and victims guaranteed qualified. He said what he said. No name calling, not even white people. Racists are not morons. Not at all. You, again, you don't dominate the universe for we don't even know how long and chalk that up to ignorance. Dominate you, dominate your father, dominate your child. That is not a moron. Unless you got a really unique definition of moron. Next. Oh, and then even within the I said that's almost one I would have not played, but I thought it was important for other reasons. But I don't want to hear anything else about Tuskegee. None of that. That has absolutely no relationship to what is happening right now. I don't care if a black person what they think about COVID-19. I don't care what they think about the vaccine. I don't want to hear any of that. All of that is, well, racism, white supremacy. That is totally irrelevant unless you're going to stop all of that. And what is the reason Ron DeSantis and Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick and the rest of these white anti-vaxxers by the thousands, anti-maskers by the thousands? You heard, well, you know, my daughter, she said the mask was itchy. I don't think she should have to be subjected to this sort of tyranny. Itchy face going to school. That's not Tuskegee. That's not sterilization. What is that? Until you give me like a logical, thorough breakdown of white people's conduct around this and saying, oh, no, I'm not doing it. Nah, get out of here. Masks are tyranny. And identifying it specifically, white people by the thousands and all over the globe. Remember, they were saying in the UK, this is 5G and all the rest of it. Until you do that, I don't want to hear anybody, even the black people, non-white people. I don't want to hear anything about Tuskegee that is like 5,000% irrelevant to what is happening right now with COVID-19. All of that. Don't even need to hear medical apartheid anymore. Glad we read that like years. We were so far ahead of the curve. Thank God. I would hate reading that right now. Next, they said, oh, right here in Seattle. Ah, oh, best play. I've had a number of people said, man, with everything that you have talked about this year, I can even pause for how bad things have been. I had a moment of celebration today. Why did I celebrate? Not because I'm at the beach. No, celebrate because it has been almost 10 days since I've had to call the police. I was ready to do the watermelon dance. Not that that is anything to celebrate at all, but wow, that is such an extraordinary sign of progress. Like, well, I can't even say progress. That's an embarrassment, but that's more what an indictment this year has been. And as I said, I've had so many folks who said, wow, like if it's that bad where you have to count how many days has it been since I've had to call the police, 911 or otherwise, is Seattle still the best plantation? I've had to ask myself, like, maybe it is no longer the best plantation. That report was in Tacoma, but I mean, we could be in Tacoma before the end of the program. In fact, Tacoma is so close, we could go to Tacoma and get back to Seattle before the program concludes. So it's not really like, you know, the airport here is SeaTac, Seattle, Tacoma. It's not really the same thing. Where you heard the report on Manuel Ellis, blackmail privilege, Manuel Ellis, blackmail privilege, who was shot and killed, were killed by enforcement officers in Tacoma. And they're being charged for this. And you heard the outrage, and they said the officers took off, and then they got money, and oh, they're service to our country. I guess they're veterans too. Talked about that. That goes all the way back with Mark G.E.D. Furman. He served in Vietnam, and then you get to come over here and join LAPD. Pattern in the system of white supremacy, often to kill non-white people. So you go kill some Afghanistans or Taliban or whatever you're calling them this week, and you come back over here, don't have any more. Oh, we're not in Afghanistan. We'll get old Manuel Ellis. Yes, you threatened us. Yes. Ah. And then you heard the tagginess of it, like terrorism all the way. We don't just kill Manuel Ellis, blackmail privilege. Then we come back and terrorize his sister. Like, who is this nigga woman to have the audacity to be upset that we killed her brother? How dare she? We're going to spy on her. Did you hear all this? And I totally believe it. None of that is an allegation or I don't know, police officer. Yes, they do. We read that. That's in Dick Lehrer's book, The Fence. In fact, they did the exact same thing to a black police officer who they beat nearly to death and left unconscious. They did the exact same thing, came out and terrorized his residence, spied on his house, set up surveillance and all this like he was some sort of drug kingpin or what have you, as opposed to a victim of white supremacy. In the book Dick Lehrer wrote, it happened to be a victim who was also a police officer. But I'm absolutely sure. And then the tackiness of it. Did you hear they tried to get a protective order against his sister? Come on. Come on. None of that is ignorance about racism, white supremacy. That is dedication through and through, all the way through. We will come and pay your bond. Get a protective order on the sister of the victim who's dead in this case, whatever. And spy on her, get surveillance and everything. All the while claiming that she is a threat to us. That's exactly what the caller in Florida talked about at the courthouse. They had a black male who was coming to do research on the sheriff and the people at the courthouse plotting, scheming. Let's get IT. Get him arrested. Yeah. We don't like this guy. Yeah, something wrong. Like, what? Blackmail privilege. Again, let's see. Oh, my God. The report on the Hall family. And I've said for a long time, my suggestion, I would not have any sort of Black Lives Matter paraphernalia like on your vehicle, on your property, in the window seal. I'm saying all that in Seattle, the greatest plantation, I've said. Man, anywhere you go in the city, I'm in Alki Beach right now. Anywhere you go in the city, Northgate, Wedgewood, Capitol Hill, Fremont, Ballard, White Center, Central District. How could I leave that out? Anywhere you go, University District, Roosevelt, anywhere you go in the city, Green Lake, you will see Black Lives Matter placards. You might not see black people, probably won't, even in the Central District, but you will see Black Lives Matter placards. Sometimes they will be enormous flags and all the rest of it. Like, you'll see them in really opulent condos where no black people live, but there will be Black Lives Matter placards in the windows and vehicles and out on the deck. And it is disgusting. Not one of the highlights of the city, in my opinion. They had a big mural. In fact, it was painted in the middle of Broadway in Capitol Hill last year when they were protesting about George Floyd, when they had the whole Chaz area at Cal Anderson Park. That's not in the street anymore, thank goodness. Anyway, they have the report on the Hall family. They had some sort of Black Lives Matter paraphernalia on their property, and this white fella comes to terrorize them. Now, I did the rewind on the segment, and it's victims guaranteed, qualified. They can respond however they want to, you know, forgiveness or whatever. They can bring him tea and cookies every day while he's serving his sentence. Victims guaranteed, qualified. I played the rewind because Mrs. Hall, she said, this kid. I said, kid, wait a minute. I'm not hearing correctly because I thought they said he was 25. I said, maybe he's 15. Did I make an error? My bad. Let me. And she said it again. She said, this kid has a lot going for him. And I said, man, I got to go back. I got to listen better. Listening is important. Let me go back. And they said, this kid is 25. That's not a kid. That was why I did the rewind. Like, that's not a kid. I almost went all the way back to he's 25. You are a grown, that A word. Man, particularly we're talking about someone classified as white. No. Dylan Stormroof, not a kid. They do the exact opposite. Now, when it's us, I don't care if it's a 12-year-old. They will say a 12-year-old, the grizzled veteran senior Tamir Rice with a gun menacing folks at the playground. Right? That's the way they'll do it for us. He's 25. Now, I know sometimes there might be a tendency if it's an older person, right? Like some Mr. Fuller's age, right? Somebody who's 90 in that age bracket, and they're talking about someone, they could be talking about someone who's 30 years old, 25 years old. And I could totally grasp them saying, oh yeah, that kid is dynamite or something like that. Because this person is young enough to be their grandchild or great grandchild in some instances. I totally get it. That is not the context here. This is a grown white terrorist. Like, what in the world? We're not talking about somebody who went out and they were throwing the football or playing a little baseball and they broke a window. Oh, my gosh. You can come mow the lawn. That's not what we're talking about. I didn't even hear the word terrorist. I heard the word kid. This is a terrorist, a serial terrorist. They said he didn't just go and destroy their property and vehicle and all the rest of it. He went and attacked somebody else's property because they had a Joe Biden sign. No. No. And if it was me, Al Sharpton, we went out, somebody had a Blue Lives Matter sign here in Tacoma. They want to support the officers. If we had trashed their car, threatened them, called them racist slurs and all the rest of it, man, black identity extreme. I would not have been a kid, a misguided kid. I'd have been a black identity extremist. They're victims of white supremacy, though. I mean, in every way, like to have your property and all that. And then did you hear they said Fredericks? Not, it wasn't just that they got one white kid. You got a whole family of terrorists. They said his father took the gun and threw it in the river to hide evidence. And then you're going to come back and tell me one, white privilege, two, you'll say that the problem is that white people are ignorant about racism. What point in this report sounds logically like we could attribute this to ignorance? This 25-year-old adult that we're going to say is a kid, not a terrorist, he doesn't like Black Lives Matter signs in black people's yards. Incidentally, I haven't heard any reports about white people being terrorized for having a Black Lives Matter sign. I see tons of them here in Seattle every day. Makes me nauseous. I've only heard these type of reports when it was a black person who had this sign. I've only heard about white people having their sign stolen. That type of a thing. Not terrorized, you could be killed, car damaged, house damaged, shot at. Only black people, non-white people. I don't know at what point you can attribute this to ignorance. The dad hiding the gun evidence, is that ignorance about racism, white supremacy? PhD experts, all of them. We are just victims, confused, and victims of terrorism. That's all I can. Victims guaranteed qualified. Last report. The most important one. It was so many things this week, man. And it was so many things happened this week, every week, this year especially. the report on Mr. Roseberry in Washington, D.C., I thought that was so important. It did not get very much attention, and it was presented as some sort of mental health issue in a number of different outlets. I thought it was so important for a myriad of reasons. When I first heard about this report, this is a white man who threatened to have some sort of explosive device. He was near the Library of Congress. They had to evacuate the Library of Congress just this week. When I first heard about this, I wasn't watching it live. I didn't see his video stream or anything like that. I just saw a brief few words, and it was ongoing, so they didn't have a whole lot of details because it was such a new, fresh incident. And so I said, I immediately attributed this to white genetic annihilation. They just had the census report. They said he mentioned immigration. I said I attributed it to that. All of the stress that's happened around everything else, COVID-19 and the shutdown, the pandemic, blah, blah, blah. All of that. I said this is just more the same with white people and their sense of white genetic annihilation. And they are acting, as Dr. Welsing said, in stage white supremacy. It's going to be more of these violent outbursts, unprovoked attacks, the airplane. You can even say that's the same thing. But it's going to be more of this type of event. When I saw the first report and they showed his vehicle, he had a black, huge, one of those SUV F-150 trucks. Not SUV, but one of those big F-150 trucks, larger than your typical pickup truck. Exactly what we talked about with Angie Schmidt, suspected racist, in her book Right of Way, where she talked about white people. We said that specifically on the broadcast, white people, and getting these enormous vehicles. Like, I gotta go and run down everybody. Dr. Welsing, the grandcestor, she talked about that, those phallic symbols compensating for that sense of genetic inferiority. I gotta get a huge black phallic symbol. And then my equalizer, I got to threaten to have some sort of explosives come down here and complain about too many immigrants in the country. The South will rise again. Miriam I. Carey, because Mr. Roseberry, white man, is in custody. They impounded his vehicle with not one shot. Now, I said I was no longer playing Melissa Harris Perry's content on the program. She did A-plus work this week, but it's too late because it's been too many Fs, metaphors all the way. But I think people understand grades. She has done very non-constructive content, in my opinion. Victims guarantee qualified, but it's not even accurate in some instances. And I've had to point this out over and over, and not being serious. Excuse, not being serious when discussing terrorism. None of those applied this week. She was great, but as they say, the metaphor, the boat has sailed. She mentioned Miriam I. Carey, which is what I was looking for. She said the word white supremacy, well, she didn't say it that way, but she did say white supremacy. Not white supremacy racist. That would have been, I would have probably had to switch and play it, but she did say white supremacy. She mentioned Miriam I. Carey and did the direct contrast, which is what I said immediately. They said in 2013 that Miriam I. Carey, a black female with her 1-year-old child in the car. Now, that's a kid. I don't use that word, but that's a child, not a 25-year-old. 1-year-old, that's a child. Her 1-year-old daughter in the vehicle. And they said, oh, she's got an explosive, and that justified executing her on the spot. Could have killed her 1-year-old daughter as well. Mr. Roseberry, still here. He threatened to have an explosive device. In fact, they negotiated with him for 5 hours. They didn't negotiate with Miriam Carey for 30 seconds. It was chase and dead nigger in the Capitol. Could have been two easily. The worthlessness of black life, all, even children. I said that black babies cost less. Total, but, and I saw very few, that's why I said Melissa Harris Perry got an A, very constructive, too late though, but she mentioned and asked great questions about that. She did have folks from the Southern Poverty Law Center on, so at any rate, I thought that was so important. I think people should pay attention to that case, because this white guy was saying things. He had social media and he had left evidence that would seem to suggest this might be a suspected race soldier. And this should be connected to January 6th. I'd said that. I think lots of folks had said that, like, hey, if you're not going to prosecute the white people who came and caused all this mischief, terrorism, you're not even going to call them terrorists. Do more of it. This is more of it. Expect a lot more of it, even that doesn't get reported. Like I said, I have personally, that's been some of the police contacts, is just white, unprovoked white terrorism against myself, random other black people in the city of Seattle. I am certain this is not just happening here. Expect lots more of this. The number again is 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. If you could take about 5 minutes to share your thoughts, observations, suggestions, that would be grand. Make sure everybody gets at least one chance to speak. And then if you have additional questions, thoughts to share, just make sure everyone has got their one turn, and then you can add your additional thoughts. If you know you're in a noisy environment, if you could use your mute button, that would be awesome. Super appreciated. If you can try to get to a quieter area, share your thoughts and then mute. That way we don't have to compete with a lot of unnecessary background noise. Other than that, no metaphors. Wow, we had quite a few of them every week. We have a number of metaphors. I'll just say that racists, as usual, use metaphors to confound, to practice white supremacy racism. In fact, a lot of those metaphors were pointed out by young Adar Abdi, black. Again, that is a black child, not a 25-year-old white man. But young Adar Abdi, she was pointing out all those racist metaphors. They just reinforce the system of white supremacy, the abuse and mistreatment of subjugation of individuals who are not white, especially black people. They are also used to just confuse non-white people. They will take two separate concepts and insist that they are similar frequently. That is not the case at all. Victims, myself included, we frequently have been exposed to this mischief, deception, and many of us, myself included, are still learning. Sometimes we'll substitute our lack of logic and use a metaphor analogy, and sometimes that just contributes to more confusion. If we could work to be precise, exact, specific with our comments, that would be super appreciated. I will prompt about the metaphors. Number again, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Let's see. First few folks dialed in with a hand up. Line should be open. Proceed.
Hello.
Irie in Louisiana. Yes, ma'am.
Uja, Seneb, prosperity and wellness to everybody. I wanted to start with what you pointed out about the young lady that lost her brother, and then the race soldiers petitioning for an order of protection. Sounds like an instance of Marcy's Law, something that we talked about a few Saturdays ago. The next thing was, I noticed listening to the NPR segment when non-white so-called black people are interviewed, at the end of the interviews, they say, thank you for joining us or whatever, and the non-white people always say, oh, thank you. Like, no, it should be you're welcome. Like, it's to me, it's like, oh, a subconscious, oh, I recognize that I'm not important and you didn't have to talk to me about this. And I'm grateful for your, for your grace or something, letting me speak on my victimhood. I am inquisitive about the current events in the so-called Caribbean with the destabilization of Cuba, with, everything that's going on with them, what is it, Embarco, and the non-white people there trying to leave, and Cuba not being in the position to help themselves as much as they usually are. And then I find that intriguing because in the past when Haiti had its natural disasters, Cuba was the first country to offer assistance, and now they can't. And I'm also curious as to whether, it could be a stretch, but I just wonder how, I'll just say it. I wonder if something happened geologically to provoke that earthquake that was not naturally occurring, considering white supremacists have admitted to influencing and manipulating the weather. So why wouldn't they manipulate the ground as well? Let me look at my notes. The next thing, the lady that was talking about her child in school, and she said she was basically relying on their promise. I don't know, based on evidence that they didn't perform as they were supposed to perform before, and you witnessed it, you were an eyewitness to your child being mistreated, I don't know how she could go off of that and try again, because her son, she doesn't understand her son is being socialized to be a victim, and it's happening very young, and that could, it's bad. I don't know what her economic situation is, but I would implore her, if she has the ability to do it, in support to homeschool, public school, nor private school. From my experience, is not a place for non-white children, especially when all of the educators and administrators are white. And Gus, when you mentioned white people being ignorant about racism, I'm pondering if a good question for white people when they say that they're confused or ignorant about racism, would a good question be, okay, well, are you confused about justice and injustice? Because perhaps, you know what I'm saying? Like, to pose that question to them, because like my grandmother would say, you know, there's right and wrong. So according to the code, there's incorrect and correct, and one produces justice and one does not. So I think that's something I might actually ask a white person if I'm in the position, and it won't be, won't have any sort of extra retribution attached to it, you know, if it's constructive enough to do. The system makes sure that we're always unstable, always in limbo. Back in another situation with my son and cannabis, that damn plant, I can't stand it. I can't. And I noticed driving around that, you know, it's just really more accessible than it was before. And I suspect that white supremacists need people to be deluded and aloof as much as possible right now as they shift or expand their priorities in a variety of ways. But I'll also end with a good note. I did, despite my stress and anxiety and fatigue, get up and exercise with a nonprofit organization that right now they're focusing on health and wellness with Black mothers and children. I participated in a Zumba class, or kind of like a HIIT routine exercise. And then the instructor said, well, what should we do last? And I said, well, maybe we could stretch. And so she asked me to come up and lead, and I led with some comedic yoga, which is the same as hatha yoga. It's just, well, some of it is different and some of it is the same. The non-white mothers and some young women that were there just to exercise as well, they didn't have children, they said, oh, do you think you can do these stretch routines with us again next time? And I said, sure, they'll let me do it. And a young lady told me that she was having some back issues. And I showed her, I don't know what it's called in comedic yoga right now, but I know it's called King Pigeon. Otherwise, I showed her that because she was talking about her hip. And I showed her Newt, which is also cat, Geb, which is cow, and the pyramid position. And, you know, reassured her to do it before she goes to bed and when she gets up, and to make sure she does it to the other side of her body. And I've been feeling better myself with my knee that was injured by, you know, somebody practicing racism at school, doing my bike and everything. So that's much better now. And I'm just doing a lot of meditating every day. And I hope people are doing that and eating well and learning about the body, because at this point, my observation is we need to learn how the body works from a biochemical aspect in order to learn how to maintain homeostasis and prevent disease. So today was a very constructive day. And but just keep my family in prayer right now, please. And I'll mute my line. Thank you. Hold up.
Much obliged, Irie in Louisiana. Bravo for going out to share some health and wellness with other black people, yourself included. Like, that's making time for yourself is worthy of kudos in and of itself. And then going to help other black people and sharing some of that, the importance of self-care. Bravo. Black self-respect. That was so important. The segment where the black mom, she was talking about being reluctant or reluctantly sending her black son back to school, like in person in school. He had been doing the virtual learning for some time. And you heard the same thing I did when I was listening to it. And I said, man, it sounds like she was like present, like she was doing a school visit or a classroom visit or whatever. But it sounds like she was like there when, I guess, whatever happened, some white child, white girl, she said, got pushed or struck or whatever, mistreated. And the teacher, I guess, wasn't looking. And so when she turns around, she immediately, your child did it, this black child did it. And she said another child, I mean, it sounded like she was there. She saw all of this. And the other child tried to tell her, like, oh, wait a minute, Miss Jones. No, he's not there. Shut up. Hear from you. Defending this nigger. He did it. You know you didn't. Didn't you touch, like, wow, like I can't even, like, I'm not a parent, but I did hear that. And I was like, dang, it sounds like she was there. But then I was like, how would that be? Like, that couldn't be. She couldn't be in the classroom. Da, da, da. But I mean, yeah, that's the way you heard it too. Like, she was there. Like, I'm not a parent, but I mean, I don't even know what the response is like to be sitting there and watching all that. One thing I can say, when you play around with sex, the joke is on the offspring. I think 90% of the time, when I quote the grandsister who said that regularly, like every time she was a guest on this program, I immediately follow it with, hey, before we hit the bedroom, let's go ahead and plan the first 10 years of our child's academic program. That way, our daughter, our son, our children, they don't have that experience. They don't know anything about that. Being in line or just sitting down at your desk and randomly accused, scolded, disciplined, maybe he could have. Who knows? You know what she had in mind? Is this going to be a suspension or a disciplinary report? Like, who knows? And even if it's not all of that, just having that sort of humiliation in front of everybody, like, what? Why are you talking to me this way? I don't even know what's going on. I'm as confused about all this. Like, and the certainty where other people can be giving you information that, no, this black child, this black boy specifically is innocent. No. You already made a decision. We talked about it for years when they talk about the school to prison pipeline. What you heard in that report, that is it right there. And I've said for years, when they do all that nonsense, it's dangerous, not even nonsense, racism, saying that it's white male patriarchy and white men and white men and white men. Hey, the school system is dominated by white women. She didn't say it was a white man who did this to her child, her black boy. I don't have offspring, but we've heard a lot of reports like that. So crude, like you said, we don't know what her finances are and what sort of other resources they have, if she has the time or ability to homeschool or whatever. But again, all of that has to be factored in before we get to the bedroom in a system of white supremacy, because that's what's waiting, in addition to Jerry Sandusky and, you know, all the rest. Number again is 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Not for spectators, folks. All of the, I don't even know what to say, confusion, incidents that happened over the week, even the COVID-19 policies, because they shifted so much. We heard in detail about what happened in New York and the requirements. I don't know if that's going to change. I know some people were still processing and trying to make sense of everything that we've dealt with for the past year or so. So I don't know if this is the new mandates and rules. Are they influencing people to change their mind and go ahead and I'll do the vaccine? Or are there people saying, hey, I'm going to stay the course. I'm not changing my mind. I don't care what new rules or what have you that they put into place. Lots of things to try to make sense of. One thing that I will share quickly, folks are spectating or getting their thoughts together. I came to Alki Beach today, and I used the water taxi, which I love. If you visit Seattle, you should definitely take the water taxi. Amazing daytime, nighttime. Obviously, it's better when it's not raining, but excellent view of the city and Puget Sound and all of that. Anyway, so I was going to get on the water taxi, and there was a white, I guess, peer agent. They have folks who work there who, you know, help you get your tickets and organize the line and all that. So the people who are working, white guy who's working there, a family, a non-white family, comes to the pier. They're going to take the water taxi. So they have very small child. When I say very small, like three, a child, not a 25-year-old grown white man, a child. And they have like two or three children, very young. I think it might be two or three families together going to the beach. Very normal summer activity. Many, many people do this all over the world. At one point, one of the younger children, like I said, again, 3 years old, looks like. They have the lines with the ropes, you know, where it kind of keeps everything organized. So a three-year-old sees all these ropes, obviously, oh my goodness, they've got a playground. So she's so small, she can just run underneath the ropes. So she's doing a little bit of a limbo, but I mean, you know, she's tiny. It's not even that big a deal. Like, she's just having a grand old time enjoying her summer. So her mom is running behind her and trying to catch her, like, oh my gosh, we got to get on the boat and, you know, stop horsing around. And the white, I'm going to call him security, but he's not security. He just works at the pier. The white pier agent is looking at all this. And I'm looking at this the same time he is, thinking, oh, she looks so adorable. That's so cute. That could be a cute photograph and all the rest of it. And it's so common. A little child having fun, running around on their way to the beach or water or what have you in the summertime. Stereotypical, very cliche, I think. The white peer agent, white male, he's watching all this. So they run past. She finally gets her daughter, finally able to run her down and grab her. They get on the boat. So I'm walking behind them, and he just looks at all this. And I think in total it may have been like maybe we'll say 10 of them in total. And so they all, boom, 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 are going down the ramp to go get on the boat. And the white guy, he looks and he's just like, wow, that was like a circus. And I just, wow, that man not, woman not, child not. Not a human, can't just be people. Almost like what she was talking about in the fantasy report that we heard at the beginning. can't just be people out enjoying the summer weather, going to the beach. Got to be animals, right? Because that's what I think of with the circus, right? You break down the metaphor at the circus. They have what? Clowns, animals, a tent, popcorn, a trapeze. I didn't see any of that. I saw a little girl, non-white girl, having fun. Her mom collected her. The family went. They got on the boat. That's what I saw. I didn't see any clowns, peanuts, none of that. He doesn't just say it once. He says, wow, it was like a circus. And he takes a breath or two and he continues to look. And he says, yeah, it was like a total three-ring circus. I didn't see one ring, not to mention three. Again, man not, woman not, child not. Like total non-persons. And this wasn't even a black family. This was a non-black, non-white family, but still, no value at all. You're like, it's like I saw some zebras and elephants and horses run through here. That's how I'm processing, racist man. That's how I'm processing what I just saw. Have a nice time at the beach. That's what we're dealing with. System of racism, white supremacy. And again, that might be connected to white genetic annihilation too. I'm sure every single individual on the planet who is classified as white has seen these reports because they've been everywhere about the census. They were even talking about that in the BBC. Probably ask about that tomorrow. Even that could be response. Just even seeing non-white people looking like they're going out, doing something constructive and having despair. That's why I said it's been all these unprovoked attacks and everything connecting. Last thing I'll say really quick, the confused, I think Irish, she made that point about when people say, you know, I'm just confused, white people, I'm confused, you know, I'm confused. I didn't know that repeatedly calling this non-white family a circus, I didn't know that that was racist. I just didn't understand. I'm confused when they start saying that they're ignorant about racism. Are you ignorant about justice? Because I think most individuals classified as white, they know what correct treatment is. They certainly know when they personally experience incorrect treatment. So I don't think they can try that. It'll be great to ask. Let's see. But I don't even think they could try that to say, yeah, I'm ignorant about what correct treatment is. I'm just ignorant about justice. That's why we keep getting over and messing over on you black people. Yeah, we're just ignorant about correctness. I don't think so. But we'll see what they say. The number is 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. If folks are just spectating for the evening, we can wrap up early. Gus T at the beach, happy to go out and kick it. I will note they had some sort of... I don't know. I'm confused because I didn't really get all the information. I was just looking inquisitively. I didn't get to go and ask. They didn't have literature, or at least I didn't get any literature to have details on what's happening. But they have some sort of event on the beach, and apparently the military is sponsoring it. So that, you know, kind of made me step back a little bit, like, but I don't know what it is. Looks like it could be a race of some sort, but they can go do some counter-racist experimenting, or at least investigating to see what exactly is happening. Is the military, or did they just have the signs up? But I think this is something military related, like maybe they're trying to recruit or something. That was what, if I had to guess, that's what I'd say it is. It's some sort of recruiting, come join the military type of a thing. Because they were giving out, like, and the curious thing, they were giving that, it looked like they were giving out, like, water bottles, and they were giving them away in some sort of packaging that had some sort of beer brand on the bag, which I thought, like, wait, if this is the military, why are they encouraging drinking? Like, what? That's why I said I just looked from afar. It's like, we have the program to do. I don't really have time to go and inspect all of this right now. I have to deal with that later and do the program. But that is taking place on the beach. So if folks are just spectating, Gus T could go and be nosy at the beach before the sun sets. There should be lots of things to try to make sense of, Rona notwithstanding. Number again, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Again, I can't emphasize enough, no flying. Again, if you have children in college or what have you, whatever, family members, period, you yourself in college, and that may require some traveling, try to drive if it's really far. If you've never taken the train, this may be the time to try it. Lots of space. You can move around. They stop so you can get off, stretch your legs, and all the rest of it. Like, I think it's much better. I haven't heard any incidents of people cutting a fool on a train and all the rest. They had to duct tape somebody. I haven't heard anything like that. It's just been people flying. That would be my recommendation. If you absolutely have to fly, earliest flight possible, no connects. Straight fly wherever you're going. Minimize risk. Let's see. The person, 1159. If you had commentary, questions to add, proceed.
Greetings, guys. Greetings, callers and listeners. The R. Kelly case reminds me of the ISIS papers, the symbolism and meaning of rape. Chapter 14, whenever I have a story about a black male or non-white people participating in that behavior, which is very, very often and common under the system, I have to be reminded of that because I don't want to be confused in viewing black males as rapists. I have to understand that that behavior was trained in us by racist men and racist women. And it's really tragic and terroristic that Haiti is forever being punished for what they did about over a century ago and their attempt to get from under the domination of racism, white supremacy. And I guess I should share a little report of what's going on in my area of the world. There's a racist child who is she's there in fifth grade, and she's a white lesbian, and she has a non-white girlfriend at the school, and I'm just wondering how many victims of racism this racist child is gonna confuse with her behavior. So I'm just observing that. And it's really, really interesting what we're dealing with here on planet Earth. And I'll mute my line.
I think Dr. Welsing, quote her again, when you play around with sex, the joke is on the offspring. And again, the way I normally follow that is, hey, before we hit the bedroom, first 10 years of our child's academic program, let's plan that out. What is that going to look like? Homeschool? Do they have independent black schools here? Can we take time maybe before we even conceive? Let's see if there are some retired black teachers, educators in the neighborhood who might be willing to, you know, pitch in an hour, you know, of their time a day just to stay active and use their brain computer in a constructive manner, continue to help some black scholars, you know, achieve their best. Is that an option? Can we take time, make time in our schedule where each of us, attempted mother, attempted father, we can trade, take turns, do different subjects, make it work? Is it possible to do it that way? Do we have other family members who might be willing to assist in this? Let's sit down and take the time to really plan this out so that we don't have this sort of problem going to school and being accused of all manner of things that you did not do, going to school and now you come home and tell me that you have a white lesbian girlfriend in the fifth grade
What? Yeah. Lots of things. Again, when you play around with sex, the joke is on the offspring. If they are going to be going into that environment, then wow, you need to be thinking, let's, before we hit the bedroom, let's sit down and talk about, now, how are we going to explain all of this to our child before they get to school so they know what they are looking at? Lots of things to think about if you are going to be an attempted parent as a victim of white supremacy. Number again, 720-716-7300, the code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. If we have folks who are in the New York area, if you have been impacted by the vaccine passport and all of that, if that either pressured you to have to become vaccinated and or you are just restricting your activities because you don't want to be vaccinated or whatever it is, that would be interesting. I think constructive for folks to just hear all of that is going in one area where they are having much more restrictions on what you can do based on whether or not you are vaccinated. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, you have commentary to share. Proceed.
May I be heard?
Caller in Florida. Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to guest hosts, listeners and callers. I wanted to start out with, I did see an article about Broward County, and they seem to be attaching their county, and where I'm at, Alachua County, is being a target for that punishment to withhold the funding, because that was another thing I forgot to mention yesterday, or maybe I did. There was a whole bunch of those papers, like small posters, posted up all over the place. County buildings, mask mandate. So it's going to be interesting how that is going to function in the next couple of weeks with the governor and everything. And then I think University of Florida, they're trying to follow what the county commission has done, bringing back the mask mandate. But I'm still seeing those reports. As Gus, I know you've seen them as well, about the white people chanting no more masks. Most of them aren't even masked or anything. And then, like, it connects with segments. Like, I think that may have been a younger white child that was saying, well, this mask caused me to sweat. It's just uncomfortable. But see, I just keep continuing to think and using logic that it's for the most part, the white adults that continuously disregard the protocols by what they call the professionals, and they continue to excuse them as all the white people being the primary factor of this severe virus continuing to spread. So it's I think of that quote Mr. Fullaway, he says, the white supremacist, I guess, plays on different sides or something like that of each argument. And definitely it's not ignorance, because they have that much power. My next one is where at the beginning segment where they were talking about the fictional stories and the fantasies and the characters and everything. So that reminded me of like how I draw characters myself. And I've been thinking about a way to try to use images and words, combine them together to talk about the system of white supremacy. And I do think that is very important with how the child was being inquisitive and asking about how there are always white characters being focused on, and all of the adjectives, silk and all of that, and milky white. And I thought that was interesting as well, like how he started to describe something that would be like an alien. And then I think Gus, I believe he did use that metaphor, out of this world. So definitely that made me think an alien as well. So, and then I noticed with the designs, if I look up designs on art website, the characters, they'll have, it'll have features like a white character would have the bell color of the character green or blue, maybe something like that. And I just find that how racism definitely is a part of pretty much everything. And I wanted to say on this last part where just even how I'm looking at a video about how markers are being reviewed, right? And it's a white woman on the video. So you have skin tone color. And she was saying how the set had like 100 and something colors, right? And she's like, man, it doesn't seem to have too many skin tones. And you can easily tell that she's talking about something that resembles pale skinned people, white people. And there'll be titles like Peach and Flesh, or, you know, colors like that. And you get to the earth, they call them earth tone. And there'll be brown complexion. But see, she didn't call those skin tones for black characters, design black characters. I can use those colors, different, as they say, shades or colors of brown. She maybe until like later on in the video started saying, well, these could be skin tones to represent all over, well, I won't say all over the place, but it's widespread, it's present in everything. And I'm just definitely going to keep that in mind with doing art. And that's all I have to share. Thanks for allowing me to speak.
Much obliged. Caller in Florida, definitely keep up the artwork. Any sort of constructive talents or hobbies that folks have, like, keep that up. If it can be applied to helping replace white supremacy with justice, do more of it. I know Pamela Evans Harris, the late, she was a big fan of graphic novels, and that was something that she talked about passionately for quite some time, in applying counter-racist concepts in some sort of graphic novel story format, to kind of make it more palatable to younger people, or maybe everybody, but especially younger people. But yeah, that was something that she, you know, was very intrigued about, passionate about, would have, yeah, supported as best she could have if she had had more time. So yeah, keep it up and use your imagination. And I'm not surprised. It might even be, you know, changing the art supplies and things, because I'm not surprised. That's everything in terms of the norm, the standard in terms of what is considered flesh tone. It's going to be something, not too much pigmentation. It's not going to be, hey, this is looking like what we can use in Nigeria and say this is flesh tone. Like, I don't think so. That's why I say it should be white non-white, not person of color. If white is going to be the standard worldwide for everything, which it is, beauty and intelligence and all the rest, well, then let's use terms that reflect that when we talk about white supremacy racism. Let's see. The whole mask situation in Florida, all of the white defiance, and I'm not going to wear a mask, and the mask makes my face itch, and all of us, I've seen tons of white people, like, it totally, easily, and the white travelers, it hasn't just been a good chunk of the anti-maskers and anti-vaxxers, because they're not taking this seriously, they have continued, you know, globe-trotting and doing their normal activities, having weddings and banquets and baby showers and all the rest of it. So, I mean, they've been big political meetings and all that kind of thing. They've been a part of these big, what they call super spreader events. So, yeah, it easily could be that white people are really the ones who are causing a problem. And then they'll have people like Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick sit around and say that it's the unvaccinated Negroes who are, you know, causing all this mischief. And even all those other, you know, many, many billions of other reports and all the rest suggesting that, yes, the echoes of Tuskegee, tired metaphor, and yes, Nurse Rivers, yes, forced sterilizations, yes, Henrietta Lacks, yes, the Negro is leery of the doctors, are like, get out of here, like, get back to Ron DeSantis. They're talking about withholding funds for wearing a mask. Like, what is his problem? Is he blaming that on Tuskegee too? Come on. Let's see. I didn't hear about the flyers from yesterday either, but I'm not surprised. We'll have to see all that, you know, plays out as things continue, especially if they say that the reports of cases are going up. Like you said, University of Florida and some other places are saying, no, we're doing masks anyway. I don't care what the governor says. Like, wow. Especially if they, you know, report an increase in cases anywhere, really, but especially in Florida, but anywhere else, like, oof. I would say that too, I guess. Prepare for things to go bad if, you know, things continue. I would go ahead and stock up now if that means you can go to Costco when it's not overflowing. Anything that you think you would need if it's going to be another month or whatever of things being serious lockdown, can't go anywhere. Just go ahead and plan for that now. Go get whatever supplies you need, water, basics, staples, toilet paper, so we don't have all that nonsense. If it happens again, I'm not caught off guard. I don't even need to go shop. I got everything. Yeast, I'm straight. I got everything I need. Get books from the library if it opened back up, all of your other resources and things, so that you can kind of situate yourself, do some exercising, maybe eat healthy, and not have to be in some sort of mad dash to, you know, get water filters or whatever else you think you might want to munch on if you have to sit at home for a few weeks. Number again, 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. We'll give folks like 5 minutes or so, see if they have other comments or they spectating any other comments on how the COVID-19 situation is being handled in your particular area or other counter racist suggestions, observations. Let's see if folks have thoughts. See, our caller, retired firefighter in Florida. Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to everyone. In South Florida, you have two nationally large school systems, Broward County and Miami-Dade County. I would say right now it is predictable that it will be chaos. Dade County primarily is dominated by white people who speak Spanish as well as English. And I would say the vast majority of that group is in support of the governor. That's why he was elected, of the state of Florida. And I don't see them being very disagreeable about his latest opinion or policy. That's better word, policy on the mask. I don't see that much protest out of that group of people. And unfortunately, non-white people, especially non-white people who are racially classified as black, is kind of like caught into that chaos. Caught into that chaos. I don't see any favor that non-white people who are racially classified as black, whether they are from another place other than the this part of the world that's called the United States or not, I don't see that much of a problem with wearing masks or following the safety rules that have been handed out by medical experts on COVID-19. I don't see any resistance on that at all, actually. I imagine it probably is some, but it's very slight. If it is. So it's going to be a problem. I would say that probably the best place to be now is a public school where the majority of the people are black. That's something good to be at then, because it'd probably be less problem. In that particular case, the administrators and teachers would be able to have a constructive relationship with the students. Being the most complicated level, of course, would be the teenagers. And I do not see a school administrator or teacher getting along with a white female teenager who does not want to wear a mask, or a male. It doesn't make a difference between the two, but no, it'll be serious problems that's going on during the entire school year until something is politically met. You're right about the idea of flying an aircraft during this period of time. It's already complicated without a pandemic. A pandemic just makes it more complicated, more hostile, potentially hostile. It is a good idea as far as traveling, and you don't want to drive long distances like I don't, to try a train. I've had experience riding on trains, and it's quite comfortable. It's not as the biggest problem. One of the biggest problems with air travel is it's a very confined space, and you're thousands of feet up in the air. So you don't have an alternative to just say, all right, the next stop, I'm going to get out. You know, you have to put up with it, so to speak. And the incidents that occurs 10,000 feet in the air puts everybody's life in jeopardy on top of it. So unless it's some sort of emergency and you really need to get there real fast, just plan not to do that. You know, make some other alternative, you know, as far as that concerned, as far as travel is concerned. That's the best thing to do. Matt, I mean, it's so bad that I've seen news accounts where they are training the personnel on the on the air flights. I don't know if they want to call it self-defense or not, but that I guess that's what they would call it, self-defense, because of the increasing numbers of incidents, of violent incidents, up in the air, yeah, and yeah, that those are just some of the thoughts that I have. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter in Florida. That's been a whole lot of white defiance too. I haven't seen, I can't think of one report of any black people, a single black person, a class of black people, none of them. You're not going to tell me to put on a mask. You're not the boss of me.
Right.
It's a new day. President Obama, right. You don't just tell me to put, not one. I can't even count the number of it. We could just talk about white children. We don't have to talk about adults. Just white children.
Right.
The number of entire, can you imagine an entire class of black children getting on a plane and cutting a fool? Black identity extreme. What I said earlier, Tamir Rice at 10,000 feet cutting a fool. Oh my God. They would blast the plane out of the air. Like, come on. Come on. Like, anyway, take that. You just heard. Retired firefighter, he took the train. That's the same experience I had. It's comfortable. Matter of fact, when I took the train, it was so much space. I had the whole seating area where I was at to myself. Like, you can move
exactly.
around and really, like, put your feet up, relax. You don't have to worry about, is the person next to me going to have a mask on? Are they going to be trying to touch me? Are we going to? Nope. You can have as much space as you want. Like, super coming in. You can go and just make sure you get the spot with the outlet. Like, oh yeah, you are in business. Like, fully charged phone, bring your tablet or whatever other device, and you can even get a sleep car. I forgot, like, you can really be comfortable. Like, get a little sleep cabin so you can have a little bed area and take the train if you haven't done the train. And you get a beautiful view. Like, that's what I love about being on the plane. You get some really good views. I didn't realize how beautiful, like, Washington State was. We went through Montana and Washington, Idaho, all those states to get to Wisconsin, Minnesota. Like, you get some amazing views from the train. If you haven't done it, this could be the time. Avoid all that nonsense in the air. Take the train. And you can switch your ticket.
And also, another difference between a train and you're driving. You know, it's on a train. You can just, if you have to go to the bathroom or get up and get something, you wanted something to eat or something like that, or you can just get up and walk to wherever you need to go. And the vehicle is still moving in the direction that it's supposed to be going in. But I mean, you can't do that in your car. You can't do that in your car. You can't do it in an airplane, you know, that sort of thing. The train gives you a lot more comfortability and movement. And, you know, at one point in time, that was the most popular means of travel for black people. Second to, well, yeah, it was most convenient and the most stylish means of traveling was by train. We're talking as late as the 1950s. On the train.
I like the train. I'm all about efficiency and all that. Like, sometimes if it's got to be there quick, hey, got to be there quick, understand. But hey, under these circumstances, I haven't seen instances of someone having to be duct taped to a train seat. Haven't seen that one. I haven't seen where they had to stop the train and throw a whole class of white people off because they wouldn't wear masks. I haven't seen that. That's happened over and over and over with flights all over the world. Not to mention the cancel. I haven't seen one report of they had to cancel train service because they didn't have staff or they furloughed or they messed up something or whatever. I haven't seen any of those. It's been hundreds, plural, of flights that have been canceled. And they got all kinds of excuses. That doesn't mean anything. You have to sit in the airport for a day. Maybe they get you a hotel. Maybe they don't. I would... the plan is already no flying this year. Whatever. If it's Christmas or whatever, if we can't drive and do it, catch you in 2022. Maybe this will be the end of all of the meetings and what have you of Christmas and all the rest of it. Maybe this will be how all of that bites the dust for some people if they had to do a lot of excessive air travel to get there and enjoy that dry turkey and dressing for, you know, Thanksgiving and, you know, all the rest of it. Any other comments folks need to make sure they get in?
Can I add something? I like the train, too. I've only really taken it twice, once to New York and once from New Orleans to Chicago. And it was really picturesque when we went to New York City. And it was just less hassle, too, and slightly cheaper. Took a little bit longer, but they tend to keep the trains up, I noticed, better than airplanes. Airplanes are always having issues. Oh, the Airbus had to be grounded, and this happened, and an engine explodes. Like, Jesus Christ, right? Excuse that figure of speech, but, you know, I don't feel so good on airplanes anymore. I started flying at 6 years old, and the other thing I wanted to add that I forgot was I went on YouTube to see what led up to the stop for the mother and in the car in Sedona, whatever, in California. And reading in the comments, you know, this is hearsay, but reading in the comments, someone said that this department has been under investigation by the FBI for quote, employing extremists in the past. So there's that. But yeah, go Amtrak, definitely. And good night, everybody.
Extremists? What is that? Historically marginalized communities. They got all kinds of nonsense. The verbal technology of our conquest. That's what I said yesterday. There's another one. Extremists. What? Racists? White supremacists. Yes. And even in that report where they knocked this black female unconscious, they said she was unconscious for like a half hour, what have you. The officers, they said they came in like the nigger woman was maybe unconscious for 20 seconds. I mean, am I supposed to count?
No, 5 seconds. The female officer said.
Say it one more time.
Oh, the female officer came behind the white male officer, white woman, and said 5 seconds.
Yeah, the minimizing, you know, all the way like, what are you talking about? Like, blink of an eye, she came right back. The nigga woman is still with us. What are you talking about? What are we supposed to get disciplined for this? Total worthlessness of black. Like, if somebody is unconscious, they could be dead. Like, what? Woo. And this is extremists. I guess this is what you expect from extremists. Anyway, Global Sunday Talk tomorrow, 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 noon Pacific. With that, oh my gosh, Larry Elder, I forgot. Man, we have to talk about that because Larry Elder racial showcasing in California. Like, man, we'll have to pay attention to that because we have California listeners, but they could actually replace a sitting white governor with a black male who has no political experience and has spent a lot of time denying the existence of racism. Stunning. We have to talk about California next time. Anywho, sobriety would be best. Man, we need high functioning brain computers to replace white supremacy with justice. If you got to go out, be alert. Unprovoked white terrorism. He's trying to bomb the Library of Congress, or at least threatening. Be alert. This is not a time to confront hostile strangers in public. If someone is saying whatever, this guy, Roseberry, is yelling out of his black mud-covered vehicle, Welsing moments all the way. You are not talking to him. None of that. get out of there. Call enforcement officers, make a report, but exit. You have no idea he might actually have an explosive device, firearms, all of the above. He might have his friends with him for reals. He said that, who also have explosive devices or whatever. If you didn't leave your residence prepared to kill and or die, exit. If you are driving, you're not on the cell phone, we need all of our attention, and we're trying to do the small things that we can, being sober, being buckled, to avoid contact with extremist race soldiers. All of that said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Man, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.